Goeiemôre and good morning to you all, honorable members, our guests here on the platform that have joined us, ladies and gentlemen.
Recording in progress.
Allow me to take this opportunity and welcome you all to our proceedings this morning as we engage in these virtual public hearings on the Agriculture Product Standards Amendment Bill. Perhaps before I proceed any further, let us send our congratulations and to His Excellency President Lula of Brazil, who has won the presidential seat, and wish him well on his term in office. It is a new dawn of hope for the Brazilian people, and we hope it will bring about stability and growth particularly, and that we may draw closer as nations in the BRICS platform, and we look forward to seeing and visiting our shores next year as we host the BRICS Summit in South Africa. Honorable members, ladies and gentlemen, these hearings are an important facet of what we term a participatory democracy, and an even greater aspect of promoting active citizenry. As with any legislature that comes before us, there are both direct and indirect impacts, and the legislative process must ensure that the process delivers what is in the best interest of the public and that minimum standards and procedures are adhered to. Honorable members, this is both in fulfillment of our role of oversight as well as consumer protection. Allow me, therefore, honorable members, to briefly return to the participatory democracy. I have stated previously that this is the bedrock of any healthy society and a functional democracy. The legislation before us, honorable members, is a case in point. As a legislative body, our responsibility is to ensure that we provide producers, consumers, stakeholders, and other members of the public in general an opportunity to comment, critique, or even question any aspect of the proposed legislation. This ensures that our process is robust and can stand up to the interrogation, review, and critique from all stakeholders. Honorable members, it is in this spirit that we welcome you all and welcome all those that will be making their submissions here today, and trust that your participation will be constructive and fruitful, and that in doing so, we all strengthen our participatory democracy and promote the principle of an active citizenry. Allow me, therefore, honorable members, to invite our first submission, which will be coming from the Agricultural Business Chamber, and it will be presented by Annelise Crosby, followed by the presentation from the South African Fruit and Vegetable Kernels Association and South African Fruit Juice Association, which will be put to us by Jill and Woods Palm, as well as Rudy Richards. We will then have questions and comments, as well as responses to that. Then we will take the presentations of the Consumer Goods Council of South Africa, which will be done by Zinhle Kike, followed by the submission from Primario, which will be put to us by John Oxenham, as well as Christopher Clifton. Lastly, we'll have a submission by the South African Organic Sector Organization, which will be put to us by Alan Rosenberg. We will have questions and comments, and then followed by responses. We plan to adjourn our meeting at 1:30 today. Honorable members, allow me to therefore invite Annelise Crosby from the Agricultural Business Chamber to proceed and give us the presentation by the Agricultural Business Chamber. You have 20 minutes. You may proceed. Annelise, good morning.
Good morning, Jefferson. Good morning, honorable members. A very good morning to you. Thank you very much for the opportunity for allowing us to present on this important piece of legislation. Jefferson very eloquently this morning spoke to the participatory process of making legislation, and I think amendment bills are a very good opportunity to improve on legislation where particular gaps in this legislation have come to the fore. So we very much welcome the opportunity. Jefferson, so let me quickly just run through my slides, if I may. For those of you who don't know who AgBiz is, our key constituents are major banks, development finance institutions, short-term and crop insurance companies, agribusinesses, commodity organizations, and cooperatives providing a range of services and products to farmers. So basically, a lot of stakeholders in the agricultural value chain are members of AgBiz. We see our function as ensuring that these agribusinesses play a constructive role in the country's economic growth, development, and transformation. We strive, therefore, to create an environment in which all agribusinesses of all sizes can thrive, expand, and be competitive. So we've got a short graph there illustrating basically the value chain. I'm sure all of you know what the value chain consists of. It's everything from input suppliers to financial institutions, logistics companies, off-takers, et cetera. And you also all, I'm sure, are aware of the contribution that the agricultural value chain makes to our economy, as well as the contribution to jobs in this country. There's just a list of all our members. It's a bit small, unfortunately, but I'm sure you'll recognize some of the logos there. Like I said, some of the key players in our agricultural value chain. So by way of general comments, just Jefferson, the amendments to the Agricultural Product Standards Act are generally positive. There are some of the definitions, some of the clauses that might need a bit more clarification. But we all know that the Act allows the Minister to designate minimum standards for agricultural products intended for sale in South Africa. And in order to facilitate this goal, it makes provision for powers of inspections, grading and sampling for quality control purposes. So the Act provides for the appointment of assignees to perform certain of these functions. The issue of cost recovery and the setting of fees by assignees has been the subject of a number of court cases. For example, we had the Woodlands Dairy case, which was heard or looked on in February of 2021, where the determination of fees was an issue, and the court held that it must be the result of a clear and transparent process and should be rationally connected to the purposes for which the decision was taken and the purpose of the Act. So I think that the amendment bill tries to cater for these shortcomings that were pointed out in these very court cases. So the court found in that particular case that the determination of fees was not rationally connected to the purpose of the act, and therefore that the fee structure was irrational. In the Bertie van Sail case, there were consultations that were conducted by the assignee, but no indication as to how the inspection fee was arrived at, nor was there an explanation of what determined the differentiated rates between different categories of agricultural products. And in that case, the court found that these omissions irredeemably compromised the fairness of the consultative process that was followed. The court also held that the powers and duties conferred upon assignees in terms of the Act are public powers. Inspection fees are aimed at ensuring compensation sufficient to meet the assignee's cost of carrying out its public duties in a competent and efficient manner. It flows, therefore, from these judgments and findings that the assignee should not generate profit and that the process of setting fees should be a completely transparent process. So that's as far as the general comments are concerned. Then we also have a few specific comments. Firstly, on the definition. So the definition of an assignee, in principle, the amendment of the definition is welcomed in the sense that it makes it clear that there should be no conflict of interest, which is critical. And that such a conflict of interest can neither be direct nor indirect. We do feel, however, that both the words interest and indirect are quite broad and should maybe be defined better so that they're not overly broad. Secondly, the definition of management control system. The Act should clarify the span of control. So from where to where in the specific supply chain is this applicable to, as well as to which industries it is applicable to. So we also feel that the Act should clarify to what extent the management control system will apply if the said products are used for inland consumption and if it's food grade or animal feed grade. So there's a bit of a clarity that we think could be helpful there. The definition of sell, it is now broadened to include transactions where no consideration is received in return. It is not clear what the rationale of the inclusion of such actions where no remuneration of any kind is received in the definition is aimed at. The word any person in the definition is also quite broad. The question arises, for example, whether this would include storage operators of grain. They are not the owners of the product to be inspected, but are they included in this kind of definition as well? So once again, a bit more clarity in terms of that definition, I think, would be welcome. Then clause 3, which means section 3, as well as the outcome of an internal appeal that was lodged last year by the grain industry against beef services, is the importance of a fair and transparent cost recovery system and structure was emphasized. The setting of a fee structure by assignees is at the core of most of the disputes with agricultural industry stakeholders. These fees also ultimately impact on the price of the agricultural products and what consumers pay for those products. We support the proposal that any fee should be calculated on a cost recovery basis and that the assignee should be required to submit a business plan as well as a budget, which is then used as a basis of meaningful consultation with industry stakeholders. Any process leading to the determination of a fee in terms of empowering legislation will have to comply with the requirements of just administrative action, including those relating to procedural fairness. And the court cases were also very clear on that. A clear and transparent process must guide the consultation, and that means basically that identifiable stakeholders will need to be thoroughly consulted and will need to be provided with sufficient information to meaningfully engage on the process of setting a fee, subject to an annual review process. The appointment of the assignee, in our view, cannot be for an indefinite period. We think that it should be for a limited time period, or that the appointment should at least be reviewed on a regular basis. In this regard, we then propose an amendment to Clause 2 to clarify that the assignee is appointed on a fixed term basis, and that the renewal of such a term follows the same public participation process as that of the individual. We're in favour of a system of accredited organisations that will be empowered to perform auditing, monitoring and compliance of certain aspects of legislation. The purpose for which an assignee is appointed must however be very clear, and it is also not clear in terms of the proposals in the amendment bill as to who will pay for the audits that will be done under the Act. Then, Chair, two issues that we just quickly want to flag that are not in the amendment bill, but can be considered in the Act, where provision is made for the executive officer to also enter into private-public partnerships or cost-sharing agreements, or to appoint persons other than assignees to perform certain functions. To facilitate this, the Act would need to allow functions to be delegated to suitably qualified persons who are not officers, subject to the qualification, of course, that they must operate under the instruction of the executive officer. So this is just to broaden up the possibilities available to the executive officer in terms of catering for the provision of services where that may prove to be a problem other than those that the Act already provides for. And then just lastly, Chair, this actually has more to do with the rules for appeals than the legislation itself, although we think that maybe the legislation can be tweaked to more clearly provide for the appeals process and how it unfolds. I wasn't personally part of the process, but in that grain appeal process last year, apparently the appeal board made some remarks that the rules were not all that helpful in guiding the process in all the different aspects. And some more clarification in terms of that could also be quite useful in charting the way forward for further internal appeal. Thank you very much, Chairperson and Honourable Members.
Thank you, Mamo Annelies Crosby, for the presentation. Honourable Members, will take this opportunity to take our next presentation, which will be from the South African Fruit and Vegetable Canners Association. Allow me to invite Jill Antwood, Palm, as well as Rudy Richards to take us through their presentation. Jill and Rudy, you may proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you for the opportunity to attend and also to present. I'll just share my slides. Okay, there we are. I presume that is reflecting on all your screens. My name is Rudy Richards, and I'm the General Manager of the Juice Association, And I'm joined by Jill Atwood Palm, and she's the General Manager of the Canners Association. So we will each present briefly our associations so that you have an understanding of what the industries are and how they are put together. And then I will discuss some of the key issues which flow from this amendment bill, an important bill, and then Jill will make some concluding remarks. So moving on to the next slide, as far as the Juice Association is concerned, we are the national representative body. Our members are processors and blenders and bottlers and packers, and we make juice products. But at the same time, we also make bulk products such as pulps, purees, and concentrates. Our membership also, though, you know, to represent the full value chain, also includes a lot of industries that support us in terms of supply and service, and I will deal with that in a moment. It's a 20 billion rand industry, and we process over 1,000 tons locally. And the domestic market represents 75% of our turnover, or approximately 15 billion, and the remaining 25% is exported. That's in the region of 5 billion. Just to give you an idea of the products, because it gives you an idea both of the magnitude and the complexity which this bill covers, and I'll just give you some examples. So it includes fresh fruit juices, products that you can buy at, for instance, Woolworths. It also includes products like liquid fruits and appetizers, which are 100% fruit juices. Then the cordials and the squashes, those are things like Halls or well-known products like Oros. And then the flavored fruit drinks, that would be flavored fruit waters, by the way, for instance. And right at the bottom, we've got tomatoes like tomato cocktails, Swiss products that you buy on the shelf. Just to give you an indication of our membership, so we have from processors like Summer Pride, which is a processor of pineapple concentrate up in the Eastern Cape. We have players like Distell. And of course, there's a number of the well-recognized brand owners which are listed there for you, which you can look at your leisure. And then the suppliers and service providers, these are machine manufacturers, they are laboratories and various other parts of the industry, including packaging. So you will see, for instance, Centropack. We all buy our milk in cartons, and we also buy our juices in cartons. So these are all part of the industry setup. Of course, we have very, very close association right at the start with Fruit South Africa and all the different producer associations. And on the other side, of course, associations which deal with the consumer, like the Consumer Goods Council. So it's very important in this whole discussion to understand that there is a very wide value chain which is affected. In terms of our juice manufacture, it's an agro-processing and beneficiation process. Starts with the harvest all the way through to the consumer. And of course, at the end of the line, the product is, a label is put onto the product. And that is the interface with the consumer, and in our opinion, the place where the inspection should take place. So that's very briefly our organization. I'd like to hand over to Jill, and then she can quickly cover the Canners Association and what is involved there.
Thank you, Rudy. Honourable Chair, honourable members.
We can't hear you, Jill. There is no sound. We don't seem to hear you. Please start that again. We didn't hear a word you said.
I am off. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can hear you clearly now. Thank you.
Okay, I did have a dip in bandwidth there. Apologies. We too represent the national interest of the processed fruit and vegetable industry. On the one hand, we have the association, which was established in 1954, and that covers the manufacturing interests relating to the industry. Alongside that, we also operate an export council focused on export promotion and marketing development, and that was established in 2005. The way that we have operated over many years is that we work in collaboration with a number of manufacturing partners, particularly on generic issues or common challenges. Case in point here today, the action that we have with the South African Fruit Juice Association is in fact on this subject. Likewise, we have in the past also worked with South African Olive Sugar Association or the Sugar Converters Association. We also have a number of key value chain linkages from national governments, being DTIC as our lead department, supporting departments, Department of Agriculture and DOCO. We work with provincial government, provincial agencies, SOEs in the likes of the PPECD, through to grower organizations on the consumer side, Consumer Goods Council, as well as our international partners in terms of international food standards, codex, etc. Next slide, Rudy. In terms of our geographic spread, it is a national spread where you find your deciduous fruit is grown predominantly in the Western Cape. We have a small pocket of pineapples growing in the Eastern Cape with an overlap into SACCU, namely Eswatini, and vegetables, tomatoes, citrus, and other fruit grown all over the country with a concentration up north. There is a significant contribution from our members to socioeconomic upliftment within the rural areas, be it in the sense of jobs, skills, beneficiated agriculture, value-added products, food security, and transformation. Next slide, Rudy. Then in terms of the value chain, very similar to that of the Juice Association and very similar to that was shown by Agbiz, most of our products, in fact, are manufactured from South African-grown fruit and vegetables, almost over 95%. There are various processing methods or derivatives of products, be it in the form of canned fruit, canned vegetables, jams, spreads, sauces, soups, pickles, and baby foods, and then into your more industrial type products in the form of pulps, purees, concentrates, and ultimately into juice production. These products have a spread of approximately 85% on the fruit side of things going into the export market, on the vegetable side of things about 95% being consumed domestically. I've also included a few statistics in terms of exports. We export around 10 billion rand worth of products. In terms of domestic, the market is around 13 billion rand. We employ a significant amount of labor with our direct partners, being the farmers, about 50,000 farmers from over 2,000 farms, and about 20,000 factory workers. So it is a significant contributor to rural development and offering quality jobs. Next slide, Rudy. I think for the context of this presentation and in terms of the joint action of SAFCA and SAFCHO, the related products that we are referring here to today is in fact the canned fruit, canned veg, canned pasta, canned mushrooms, jams, jellies and marmalades, mayonnaise and salad dressings, and fruit juices. And I wish to hand you back to Rudy, who will continue with the presentation. Thank you, Trey.
Thank you, Jill. All right, so I'm going to start off with the regulatory system. And just as Agbiz have referred to a long period during which there was activity regarding assignees and inspections, I think also our comments need to be seen in the context of that period of about 5 years, where there were many court cases, there were many discussions, and there were many issues which we all tried to resolve. So I think the first thing is that these regulations, they flow from the Agricultural Product Standard Act, and they cover quality requirements. So this is not really about safety and anything else that's covered by other departments. It's about the, in our case, the juice regulations, but in Jill's case, there are regulations for canned fruits and the other products that she mentioned. It took specifically covers things like labeling related issues, like how you describe the product, and also what you can put on the label, depictions of fruit, and these sort of things. So these are quality requirements. We fully support these regulations, and there are two very clear reasons why we do that. First and foremost, our priorities are consumers. So what we do must be to produce a product which meets the requirements of the quality standards, and that's to the benefit of the consumer. But secondly, also, we want to make sure that we match world standards. Our standards have got to be in line with what's done in the rest of the world. You know, if we want to export products, we should have products which meet those standards. And then secondly, on the same vein, we need to ensure a standardized or level playing field in the domestic market. However, I think it needs pointing out that regulations, they need to be updated from time to time. We have developing technologies, we've got product innovation. Developing technologies would, for instance, cover the processing of fresh juices. Product innovations, you know, things like spritzers didn't exist 10, 20 years ago, now they do. And all the functional additives, these all have to be regulated. And, you know, soon we'll be adding cannabis to our products, and, you know, how do we regulate that? And then, of course, best practice in terms of inspection models, we need to be in line with the movements and the developments of overseas countries, how they doing this and how the best practice is panning out. So that is the regulatory system, quality, and we support that 100%. In terms of compliance, again, our message is actually quite simple. We fully support compliance. And the primary responsibility for ensuring compliance lies with the manufacturer. So our individual members, they've implemented comprehensive total quality management systems. They're extensive, they're costly, and they're very effective. We've got numerous certifications that can be listed at another point in time. And these systems, they cover us all the way from the supply of the raw material back to the supply of the raw material all the way to the consumer. That expression farm to fork is sort of relevant. It's the whole process. And these quality systems don't only inspect the product, the final product, but they're in line. Because obviously the last thing we want to do is to have a whole long process and at the end we have a resultant product which does not meet the standards. So they're in line, that's quite important, and these systems are around in all the manufacturing facilities. In addition to that, all our factories are subject to rigorous inspection and approvals, especially by export customers. This is a long-standing thing and it continues. And then there are other systems in place besides that. For instance, brand companies and others have extensive feedback mechanisms. And the objective is obviously to ensure that we meet the quality standards in the market, and the consumer is the most effective controller of that. And then in terms of industry initiatives, we have voluntary plans and programs in place to both assist and encourage, but also to promote compliance. So from an industry perspective, we are fully committed to compliance, and we've made significant investments in ensuring that we have quality systems to ensure that. As far as the government role is concerned, on the first step, we obviously accept that the government has got a role to play and that they need to take regular and reasonable steps to ensure that the regulations are adhered to. But we also need to recognize that this additional inspection cannot be in respect of every single product. That's not practical, that's not feasible, that's not cost effective. And in any event, that would duplicate the whole system that is already in place. So we need to utilize existing systems to the extent that they can be to ensure the compliance of our products and to satisfy the government's perspective that we need to ensure that reasonable steps have been taken. So in our opinion, the methodology focus should therefore be on, firstly, random sampling in the market at the point of sale where the product meets the consumer, because that's where the final product is. And that's the product that the consumer receives, and that's what we should check. In addition to that, there should be an audit of the total quality management systems from randomly selected individual companies, and the idea there is to determine the risk profiles of those companies. This would especially happen when a product fails its inspection at the point of sale. And this would be in line with modern inspection models. I think also, okay, let's just go on to the financial considerations. The additional inspection systems that we wish to apply, they must achieve a reasonable assurance of compliance in a cost-effective way. But I think it's important to be aware of the current economic conditions out there in the in the country. We don't want to put an unnecessarily costly or additional regulatory burden on the value chain. And also, we don't want to increase the cost burden on struggling consumers. So I think whatever we do must have this in mind. And therefore, to do that, three suggestions that we are making here is, firstly, we can't and should not be putting costly structures and methodologies in place which do not add value. Secondly, there must be no duplication in the value chain. We don't see any point in inspecting the bulk products when it's in any event going to go through a reprocessing exercise to produce final product. There's no point in inspecting the pulp when jam is still to be made from that, or the concentrate when juice is still to be made. And then we also don't want inspection at the manufacturer point, at the distributor point, and also at the retail point. You know, in our opinion, it should be at the final point. So there are no further variables in the chain of delivery. And then it's also important to think to remember that product categories differ. So whatever is put in place must be fit for purpose for that product category. Some categories have got short life and long life. Some categories, like honey and jam, they, for instance, are very much farm production, or often farm and small production, and then the farm stores. So that's a completely different set of rules that need to play. And then we also need to remember that there's an increasing trend for processing at point of sale. In other words, not in a big factory out in the rural areas, but actually in store. So these are all things that need to be taken into account when one develops a system, and it should be fit for purpose. Then moving on to governance, I think Agbiz also alluded to this issue of the appointment of assignees, especially when they are private companies. Private companies have profit motives. It's got nothing to do with cost recovery. It's about profit and distribution to their shareholders of profits. And this provides a significant and really difficult conflict of interest. And that's been one of the subjects of a lot of dispute over the last 5 years. So I think this is something that we really need to take into account. In our opinion, appropriate government oversight measures are needed. Again, the subject of much debate and legal proceedings over the last five years. It's got to cover those departments which are involved, and it's not just one. In our opinion, the PPECB model actually provides quite a few good examples of the appropriate methodologies and also governance. It provides for industry involvement. It provides for procurement practices, and it also provides for methodology to determine the fee. So that to us is quite a good example of a lot of the guidelines that we can follow. I think we've all made a lot of detailed suggestions, whether it's Agbiz or Consumer Guidance Council to follow, and I think these are all relevant and they need discussion. The idea was not to deal with them in this presentation, rather to give the context of what what we're talking about. Whatever route we take in terms of methodology and cost, though, you know, our plea is a consultation. Let's work together as partners because we've got mutual objectives. We all want compliance and we want to do it in the most cost-effective and value-adding way. Then I'd like to hand over to Joel. If you can take us through the concluding remarks, Joel.
Thank you, Rudy. You know, just wrapping up and putting this all into context, and I reflect again on the detail provided by Rudy, as well as the points already made by Annelise of Agbit. But this oral presentation that we have the opportunity to present at today should be read in context with our more detailed written submission dated the 26th of September, which also highlights and again just summarizes some of the points raised here today, but the need for clarification around some of the definitions. Some examples already quoted today, issues around the designation and the appointment of assignees, fee determination and the whole premise of cost recovery, the principles of audit and or inspection, or audit versus inspection. Clarification is certainly needed around that. And then a clear understanding of a management control system. I think points 4 and 5 goes to the root of the methodology. And this is, in fact, the area where consideration of a risk-based approach can, in fact, be taken. And the other elements as well of significance, elements like historical compliance. These are manufacturers who have a long history of manufacturing. And also there is a history of compliance that's already been recorded that would be able to form a very solid basis for a methodology going forward, as well as what Rudy's mentioned, our existing PQMS or product quality management systems that are already in place in so many of the facilities. Also highlighted previously, it should be seen in context of the broader aspect, as there are certain elements that could also be included in this amendment bill. There are a number of rulings and judgments that occurred over the past 5 to 6 years relating to some of these core issues. And I think, again, it goes to the core of our promotion of administration of Justice Act, and that pertains to administrative actions, and here so particularly around the need for consultation. And then also the PFMA, which deals with elements of accountability and governance. Again, pointing to the issue of the determination of fees. Next slide, Rudy. Again, and this is maybe looking at an even broader picture, but perhaps the time is here for us to have a look at the agri-food environment or regulatory environment in a much broader way. As manufacturers, as processors, we have certainly picked up fragmentation or the duplication of actions across various acts. And here it goes beyond the Agricultural Product Standards Act, which in fact is under the custodianship of the Department of Agriculture. But then you have the Foodstuffs and Cosmetics Act that is sitting under the Department of Health. And then you have the Consumer Protection Act, which is under the custodianship of the DTIC. So these are all critical agri-food elements spanning across food quality, food safety, consumer protection, and it's spread across various government departments. As I say, often resulting in fragmentation or duplication and also added costs. So in order for us to take a more holistic approach, perhaps the remodeling or the review of the entire food, agri-food system is now an opportunity for us to look at. And then just in summing up and pulling this all together, there is indeed a need for meaningful consultation, for mutually beneficial, relevant, streamlined, practical, and most of all, affordable system, which is implementable within a reasonable time frame for the greater good of all stakeholders. And here we're not just talking on behalf of industry, but for government and consumers alike. And on that note, I again thank you for the opportunity, and yes, we're open for any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Rudy and Jill, for your presentation and submission. Honorable members, there are the two presentations which we've received. We will now open the session for questions of clarity and comments on the two presentations which we have received from Annelise Crosby of the Agricultural Business Chamber, as well as the one from the South African Food and Vegetable Canners Association by Jill and Rudy. We'll open the floor for questions of clarity or comments. Honorable Kabe.
Thank you, Chairperson. Greetings to you, my colleagues, and all the stakeholders on the platform. So let me appreciate the presentations from both presenters. One chair, I'm sitting here, and my observation as an when I was listening to this presentation is that there's no fundamental disagreement to the bill. There is support as to what needs to happen for this amendment bill. And Chair, I think both presentations are agreeing that there has to be control and management of the system, as it is the intention for this bill. That gives an opportunity for export, for controlling quality, not only local products, but also the products that gets imported to the country. Now, Chair, my difficulty is understanding the issue on assignees from both presentations. If both presenters, Annelise, Jill, and Rudy could explain what is the issue around assignees through the director, and also what is the concern on the fees. I had shared the last slide from Jill about the need for consultation. They have submitted, according to them, oral submissions. They are here today also submitting. What is the concern? Because you say there's need for consultation. Who are we consulting again? Or are they not the relevant people? What is the feel about the consultation? Because looking at who they represent, for an example, her and Jill, her and Rudy, it's a lot of companies, it's a lot of stakeholders under their umbrellas. But now, if she says there's a need for consultation, what does that mean? The issue on fragmentation, Chair, for me, we will forever have different products, be agricultural, being regulated under different departments. For an example, if we have an oil and with us do a cooking, it becomes a food substance. But if we take the same oil and manufacture it into a medicinal product, it will go under the Department of Health, that will where it should be regulated. So we'll have medicinal products that their base is agricultural, and you will have agricultural products that talks to the food products that you seek to regulate. So issue of fragmentation for me is very broad and will not stand the test of time for now under this bill. Even if you want to, we'll always have that. But Chair, I am satisfied with the evidence thus far that there's no fundamental difference or a feel that this cannot go on. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Tape. Honorable Mamun Babama.
Chair.
You may proceed, Dr. Masipa, in her place.
Thanks. Chair, thanks very much to Rudy, Jill, and Annalie Crosby. Chair, I think my just really point of clarity is basically what Metlape said with regards to consultation. And here a presentation by Jill emphasizing the consultation. And just to understand from the presenters as to how much consultation was done regarding this particular bill with the industry, with themselves, and if there is obviously need for additional consultation, how much consultation is required, and what are areas that they need to thresh out. I think they are clear that there are a number of bills that maybe needs to be require some alignment, which I definitely agree that, you know, Chair, let's not only just look at ticking the box that we have done with this bill, you know, come into the House and debate it and we passed it, but really hasn't really addressed the issues that the industry is faced with. So I just want to get clarity there with regards to the consultation that has taken place. Chair, obviously there has been an issue with regards to grain cost recovery and so forth. I just want to understand from the two presenters, because at the moment there are obviously the audits that are taking place through either the APEC and other industry, call it recognized audit and regulation. In terms of this, call it the new assignee, and I got involved with the Grain SA assignee issue some time back. In terms of this new assignee, what is going to be the difference from in their perception, the difference from the way that this new regulation is bringing the new assignee as compared to the current model that is being used in the industry to assist them with the audit and to ensure that their products are compliant. Really around the weaknesses of the current assignees, you know, why is it that important that they need some kind of this regulation, especially talking back to grain leafy, I think it was an assignee which obviously caused some concern in that particular space. So basically, Chair, I think there is a need for control and audit in the industry, and I think the industry is happy, but I think there are elements that I get a feel that industry don't really want to have a shotgun approach, but to make sure that the whole system is really talking to one another. Yeah, I think that's it from my side, Chair. But the last part, Chair, is I did raise it with the department, but in terms of the small emerging producers, you know, as to how they are going to be able to be accommodated regarding this particular new approach. But I think that is the department to answer in terms of how they're going to really support them and to ensure that their fruit or their produce are compliant to the market standards, because I think that's been an issue with regards to especially the small producers and the ones in the rural areas. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Ntatema Sipa. The Honorable Memato. Memmaşor Dumela. Tim, Malkapa. The Honorable Malkapa.
Thank you, Chair. Mandibulele. And let me thank also join in accepting the presentations. I only have a few, I think it's not only two. The other one was touched by Honorable Tape, and this is on the mention of fragmented duplicate and duplications. I was also having a concern or a feeling that this one to me seems unavoidable, but maybe they can further elaborate on this, because these acts which are presented there, they have mentioned, to me they serve different purposes. For instance, another act can be related specifically to health, and another one on agriculture can be specifically related to the quality of the product, that, and so on. Therefore, I would like to have another opinion on this part. And another one also is on this additional regulations which are said to be a burden. I understand this, but I would also like maybe Mr. Rudy to link this for me with the practical situation that has happened several times, that a product is being recalled when it's already on the shelves, and therefore in that case how do they relate that with this what is regarded as duplications? I thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Tapa. The Honorable Ntate Matias. Dr. Matias Dumet. Hey, Mufuke Dumel. The Honorable Musi Chwete, Mamu Chwete.
Thank you, Chairperson, and good morning to everybody in the meeting. Chairperson, let me apologize firstly. Maybe the noise on my background will disturb a bit. There's construction work happening in my area. Chairperson, the question that I had was around the issue of consultation, and of which both Honorable Masipa and Honorable Ntape already covered, Chair. I will just await the responses on that one.
Thank you, Honorable Chwete. The Honorable Briet.
Morning, Chairperson.
Morning, how are you today?
Good, thanks, and yourself?
Very well, thanks.
Chairperson, I just have maybe just to add my voice in terms of the remark on consultation, maybe just to find out what was the consultation process, were they included in the initial consultation process? I think Honourable Masipa and Honourable Slavi, you know, covered that broadly. And then I think in terms Now I've lost my word, Chairperson. I'm sorry. but in terms of, I specifically want to, I think it was Annelise Crosby that mentioned funding, and we just need specifics in terms of how funding will happen. We need to have clarities on that. I would like to find out which clarities she distinctly wants. And I just want to know, I have not looked at their written submission, whether they have included clarities or maybe in terms of proposals they would like to see. And I would further leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Akhbare Briet. Honorable Mema Shadi. Honorable Mema Shadi.
Thank you very much, Chair, and good morning to you and colleagues on the platform. Chair, I think I'm covered in terms of questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable Mema Shadi. Ndabezitha Kosenkulu, the Honorable Sebekulu. Honorable Sebekulu. Honorable Linda de Kruger. Bau Kruger. Honorable members, any other honorable...
I'm sorry, I'm covered, thank you.
You are covered, Honorable Kruger, thank you. Any other honorable member on the platform who has a question or comment on the two presentations you've received? If no further questions, honorable members, we will then revert back to the presenters for responses. I will give the opportunity first to Mayor Annelise Crosby from the Agricultural Business Chamber. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you very much, honourable members, for those pertinent questions. First of all, I'm going to try to respond to the question around consultation because that came up a number of times. There were three different members, I think, that asked about that. The point that we make around consultation is not around the consultation that was done for the purposes of this bill. As far as we're concerned, you know, that's been sufficient consultation. There's been opportunity to do that, and it's not a particularly controversial bill. But the sort of context in which we allude to consultation is the consultation that needs to take place when the legislation gets implemented in terms of where an assignee has been appointed, and that assignee must now go away and do its work, must go and do the necessary inspections or whatever it has been mandated to do by the executive officer. That holds a lot of implications for consumers and the industry alike, the way in which that inspections are being done. Because there are sort of numerous ways in which the assignee can go about that, and all of that may have different cost implications. So, for example, to give you one example, just the number of inspections that a particular assignee may decide to do will have an impact on the cost. If there are more inspections done, it will obviously be more costly. So there needs to be a very clear framework within which the assignee does those inspections, and the industry and all the affected parties need to be consulted when that business plan, which really is then your framework, is accepted and when the budget of the assignee is approved. So the consultation for us is that is important is that consultation in terms of FAJA that must take place to set the sort of the guidelines within the which the assignee, which is really, you know, it's an sort of an outsourced competency of the department, that the inspections used to be done by the department. Now, in many cases, they're done by assignees. That therefore, the oversight and the consultation there is very important. So I hope that clarifies the remarks with regard to consultation. Honourable Topping, yes, indeed. I don't think there are any in principle objections to the bill. There are a number of clarity issues which I have raised in terms of certain of the definitions and also the management control system and the new type of assignee that the bill seems to envisage in terms of that. It's not quite clear to us, you know, exactly why that is required and what the function of those assignees would be. So it would be useful to get more clarity on that. In terms of duplication, I think Honourable Masipa raised that. It's not just a question of duplication between, for example, Department of Health and the Consumer Council and all of that, the Consumer Protection Legislation and all of that, but also just in terms of the APS Act and the inspections. You know, inspections can be done on a raw product and then once again on the final product, and that to us seems like a duplication, which is probably not necessary. And once again, it has a cost implication if you inspect both the raw product and the final product in every instance. Yeah, okay, and then Honourable Buys questions around the funding. It's actually the auditing where we raised the question as to, you know, who's going to pay for the auditing because it's not clear from the bill. We didn't put any specific proposals in our written submission, but if it would be of assistance to the portfolio committee, we can certainly go back to our members and find out from them if there are any specific proposals in regards to how that cost should be dealt with. Jefferson, I don't know if I missed any, but thank you. Those are my responses.
Thank you, Mamo Annelise Crosby of the Agricultural Business Chamber. We'll move on to the responses from the South African Fruit and Vegetable Canners Association by Rudy and Jill. You may go ahead.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for those questions. I think one of the first questions was about what are the issues regarding the assignees. And I'd just like to comment on that. I'd firstly like to reiterate, we are 100% supportive of regulations. We are 100% supportive of compliance. It's now all about how do we ensure that compliance, the methodology and the cost. And that turns to the question of the assignee and the implementation. Because in our opinion, the assignees are not always qualified to do the job. I think it's imperative that they have a proper understanding of the dynamics of the industry, and also that they have detailed operating procedures so that the costings can be calculated. I think suffice to say that the assignees for dairy and for processed products, both their licenses were revoked. So that's a clear indication that the assignees that were appointed were, in our opinion, not qualified for that job. And that is a concern for us. Then onto the second question, obviously any appointment of a new assignee must take that into account. We need to look at the mistakes that we made in the past. The second thing is this question of consultation. The one question is that we represent a number of companies and how would the consultation take place? Well, again, I think it needs to be understood that our comments are in the context of what's happened over the last 5 years. Over the last 5 years, assignees were appointed, I think, way back in 2017. There has been court case after court case. It's not only the one mentioned, which was grain. It's also dairy. It's also the processed products. It's also fresh produce. And in all of those cases, the conclusion was that consultation was insufficient. And that's why we, you know, we're emphasizing that point. I think Annelise has also hit the nail upon the head. There's two types, or there's two areas of consultation. The one is this APS amendment bill, and the other one is the actual implementation once an assignee has been appointed. The past 5 years is not about the actual regulation or the bill, it's about the implementation. And that's where we've been at loggerheads. The consultation on the amendment bill, I mean, that's taking place now. That's why we've all made comments, and that's why we're all on the same platform. So I think that's moving us in the right direction. And certainly from our detailed submissions, there's a lot of good suggestions being made. We haven't heard all of them, but we will certainly hear later in the morning. So that is great. But the biggest problem will arise when it comes to implementation. Because there it's imperative that we have a system which is fit for purpose, which is cost effective, which is functional, et cetera, et cetera. And that has been a major, major problem in the last 5 years, and that's led to all these various debates. I'd like to answer one other question, which I think is also very pertinent, and that's a question about product recall. I think it's always unfortunate, obviously, when products are recalled. You can remember the issue about the canned meats and bolognese. You can also remember there was a baby food issue, and there was also a juice issue where some of the products were recalled. These, though, have got nothing to do with today's discussion, in the sense that they are not within the ambit of the quality regulations of the Agricultural Product Standards Act. Those are all safety issues. So in the one product specifically, which was the juices, the product was recalled. There was potential concern about safety. It falls under the Department of Health. It's got nothing to do with these regulations. So here we're talking about quality regulations. Those product recalls were unfortunate, and they are dealt with by the companies and also by the respective departments, but actually outside the ambit of the Agricultural Product Standard Act. So those are three comments. I don't know, Jill, if you'd like to add anything.
Thank you very much, Trudy. I do believe, I think we've answered all the questions, as most of the questions, in fact, went around the consultation process. And I do believe that we've covered everything. Nothing further from our side. Thank you very much.
Sorry, Chair, I'd just like to add one point. Obviously, we represent the industry, and so do many other organizations. We are very happy to consult, and we're available to consult and to consult with our members and in turn with anybody that requires our input. So as an association, we are quite easily able to represent, and also the Canada Association, to represent the different manufacturers.
Chairperson, can I just ask a follow-up
thank
question?
Thank you, Rudy and Jill, for the responses. Honorable members, I see the hand of Honorable Ntate Masipa, and I see Ntate Kruger breaking protocol. You should raise your hand if you have a follow-up question, Ntate Kruger.
Okay.
Meeting, and I'm still speaking, Honorable Kruger. You may raise your hand if you do wish to have a follow-up question or if you need to have further input. Honorable Ntate Masipa, you may proceed if it's a follow-up question.
Yes, Chair, it's a follow-up. Thank you very much for the opportunity. And thanks for answering the clarity seeking questions. Chair, I might have really forgotten to respond to this question. I just wanted to get the difference between the current fee determinations of the assignees that are doing the audit on this product and the envisaged fee determination that Spain proposed on this current bill. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Ntate Masipa. Any other follow-up questions, Honourable Members? Yes, Honourable Kruger.
I'm very sorry, but I'm sitting with my cell phone and I don't know how this, you know, born before computer, so I don't know how to put up my hand on my computer.
Arrange with Honourable Ntatema Sipa to take you for induction so that you can be assisted in utilising these systems, Honourable Kruger, but you may proceed.
Thank you, Chair. You're very kind. Chair, I just want to ask the Agribusiness Chamber. You know, small businesses, in especially around the world, but especially in South Africa, their biggest problem succeeding is red tape. And so I just want to find out from Agribusiness Chamber, if this proposed amendment bill is going to cause more red tape or less red tape. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Kruger. Honourable Members, any other follow-up questions? If not, let us revert back to the presenters. Mamo Annelies Crosby.
Thank you, Chair. Both of those are quite difficult questions to answer, Chair, and I'm not sure that we are best equipped to try and respond to those, but let me try. Honourable Masipa, what is going to change is the not the fees itself, but what is being clarified is how that fees are to be determined, what process needs to be followed to get to a point where the fees by the assignee are going to be determined. I don't think it should make a difference, you know, in whether it's going to be more or less, but the process is clarified, which is a good thing. I hope I understood your question correctly. And Honourable Kruger, with regards to, I think, you know, what needs, I like that summary by the other two presenters where they said what is needed is a mutually beneficial, relevant, streamlined, practical and affordable system. They, of course, affordability is very important, but I think all of us also understand the need for quality assurance and for some kind of inspection service. And so once again, the Act is already in place. It already provides for a system of assignees. There are a number of assignees in place, quite different in how they constituted PPECB being a statutory body, SAMIC having a lot of industry involvement, LEAF being a private company and all of that. But it's, the bill doesn't change that. They're already in place. What the bill tries to do is to improve the systems of consultation and oversight, in my view, as far as the assignments are concerned. I hope that answers the question, Chair. Thank you.
Thank you, Mamo Annelies. Ntate Rudy and Mayor Jill, please proceed.
Thank you, Chair. I think just very quickly, the fee determination, I think it's more clearly set out now that on a cost recovery basis. I think the problem arose previously, and that was the appointment of private companies with profit motives. And they certainly did not apply the cost recovery basis, and all they intended to do was to increase their costs in any event. So I think that's where the conflict of interest arose, that private companies with a profit motive were appointed to do something on a cost recovery basis. So, and as Annelies says, this is nothing new. Our issue is not about the basis on which the fees are determined. The cost recovery is correct. but we need to look at the issue of private companies. As far as red tape is concerned, I think that's an important question. It really depends, and I hate to harp on it, but it's on the consultation with regard to implementation, when the assignee is actually appointed. If we do not put in modalities which are cost-effective, streamlined, et cetera, it is certainly going to increase the red tape, especially for small companies. Now, big companies have got the capacity to put systems in place. Small companies, not. So that is why it's important to have consultation with regard to implementation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. Just to add in there, again, you know, the issue isn't around the actual amendment bill. I think it's quite clearly set out in terms of the areas that need to be covered. But where, in fact, the detail will be required or our energies would need to be focused is, in fact, around, number one, the methodology. How, in fact, is the process going to be implemented? What is the process to ultimately determine fees? So there is, in fact, flowing from the amendment bill, a number of issues that would need to follow. And that is, in fact, where proper and due consultation would need to be, would need to take effect. So it's, again, really just summing up what the previous two speakers have emphasized. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Mamu Jill and Dr. Rudy. Honorable members, let us appreciate and thank our presenters for this first round, which was Mamu Annelise Crosby from the Agricultural Businesses Chamber, as well as Mayor Jill and Wood Palm, and Dr. Rudy Richards for their inputs. We will now take the opportunity of welcoming and inviting a submission from the Consumer Goods Council of South Africa by Zinhle Tsike, which will then be followed by a presentation from Primario, which will be done by John Oxenham, as well as Christoph Clinton. We may proceed, Zinhle. Good morning and welcome. You are muted, we can't hear you.
Good morning, Honorable Chairperson. Can I request that we are allowed to share our presentation? We are unable to. I've got my colleagues on the line, Neo Momodu, who's going to be sharing on my behalf.
Perfect. Can we request the Secretariat, Manyamza and Mam Kakaza, to assist Umamu Zinhle to ensure that they are able to share their document on the screen?
Umamu Zinhle is a coach.
Neo Momodu. Neo M. Yes. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
While we are awaiting honorable members, the presentation to be flighted, allow me to also welcome our parliamentary legal advisor, Umamu Jekeline Melo, as well as Barbara Lutz, who are from the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor. We have Umamu Koliswa Dludlu, who will be engaging with the committee in assisting us to navigate through this amendment bill. How are we doing, Mamu Kakaza?
Done, Chair. Thank you.
You may proceed, Mamu Zinhle. You have been made calls. Please unmute your microphone. It's muted. We can't hear you.
Thank you, Chairperson. We're going to try and share again. Give us a few minutes. Thank you. thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity, and good morning, colleagues and honourable members of the court. I've got my two colleagues who's going to be sharing with me the presentation, Ms. Mel Momodu, as well as Matlo Sidati. Just to comment on our presentation, we are the Consumer Goods Council of South Africa. We are an industry association. We represent 9,000 members we're an industry association representing over 9,000 member companies in the consumer goods, retail, and services sector, which is one of the largest employers in South Africa. Our vision is to be a leading platform for engagement of consumer goods manufacturers and retailers in South Africa. Our mission is to improve non-competitive consumer goods industry business practices through vibrant collaboration, advocacy, and action for the ultimate benefit of the consumer. Next slide. How do we do our job? We do it through promotion of matters of common interest that is non-competitive, enable members to trade better and meet the needs of the consumer, support and disseminate relevant and key information to enable and enhance increased efficiencies for the members. This we do through supply chain efficiencies, trade, standards, technical, as well as security and skills development initiatives that we do in our organization. Also, we provide thought leadership through our seminars and industry research and education programs that we do. And also, we are a voice of our members through to government and other key bodies or on relevant legal and regulatory affairs. This is our board members. This is our board members are represented by manufacturers as well as retailers and service providers in the sector. This is our board members mostly. On general comments, members. We're going to just start with the economic realities and challenges that have been facing our members. The effect of COVID, which resulted in job losses, personal and business closures. The 2021 July unrest that resulted in about nearly or more than 50 billion rands in losses for our members, as well as the KZN disaster from the flood that we have in the beginning of this year, which resulted in about 5 billion to date. And we have a Tongaat bridge that has not been even rebuilt, and that is creating the ability to trade in the KZN. Challenges of weak infrastructure, especially in relating to electricity supply and road networks, is a big challenge for our members. And today we had Honorable Kruger referring to the red tape issues and legislative issues. These, in our view, we believe that our biggest challenge in terms of how we can get more businesses to participate in the sector, such as the bill that you're talking about today, the ASAP Act, the health promotion levy, the plastic levy, as well as the Consumer Protection Act, just to name a few. These are all impediments or red tape that are applied by government in the sector. So we all are aware of the ongoing war in Russia as well as in Ukraine and its subsequent fallout, which has resulted in high global fuel prices and imports of seed and grain, which is pushing up the consumer inflation. So as PGCSA, the colleague on the poor previous presentation has referred to a number of cases that have been taken before court. There's about four or five cases that will be in court, and as PGCSA as well, we can see the last point there. We are in court since 19 August, and we are going back to court on the 17th of September. The result of these court cases is that all the assignees and all the ministers losing these cases. That's creating an environment where we are back and forth in court and not doing what we're supposed to do. The court findings were centrally on the regulation of the cost attached to the assignee when we operate in an environment which is not regulated and thus creating regulation uncertainty. So as an industry, what we want is to comply. However, we need certainty with the fees, which are transparent and fair, to enable our members as well as the industry to be able to operate in a fair environment. As I said earlier on, as we are digitizing, we are taking the Ministry of DARA as well as Food and Agriculture Agency to court on this matter. Section 2 of the SFS empowers the Minister to designate and appoint an assignee. The Minister started exercising this power since January 2007. And the reason of that was that they are due to capacity constraints in the Department of Agriculture, Forestry and Fisheries, which was there at the time. And in 2019, DEF merged with the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform to establish what we know now as DARAD, or the Department of Agriculture, Land Reform and Rural Development. What we want to recommend to the committee is that we call for an audit to be conducted in the department to determine the inspection capacity. This will include the job functions of individuals who are still in the department and who are employed as inspectors or to conduct inspection services. Why we want to do this? We believe that the audit will assist in the assessment of whether the assignees, as they are being appointed currently, are still in need, because they come at a cost to the industry and ultimately the consumer when we are all operating in a constrained environment and it's economically challenging. I'm going to hand over to Neo Momodu, who is my colleague, so that I can talk to the actual submission. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair and honorable members. Before I go to the actual submissions, and just on the point of an audit that is needed for the department, you will note that as early as about a month ago, the department actually revoked the services of two of its assignees, and that is Naja Mogul and Mpumelelo. And 2 days ago, when we sat in the meeting, I think it's yesterday, with the department, they indicated that the department itself will now start conducting inspection services at a cost. It therefore says to us, all along, there have been a capacity within the department to be able to conduct these services. Now, if the reason that was given previously was that assignees were appointed because of lack of capacity, and we need to be clear here that we're not questioning the minister's constitutional responsibility or duty to be able to appoint assignees. What we're saying is that the reason at the time was capacity, and in these tough economic environment, we need to really see if there is still a need for assignees, given the fact that the department, by our own assertion of about a day or two ago, saying that they will now start conducting these inspection services, given the fact that they have revoked the responsibilities of Major Mogul and Mpumelelo. Going specifically to the submissions, we looked at the general comments that we spoke about, and now we're looking at the definitions. In the Act itself, the amendment seeks to amend the definition of assignee. And when we look at Section 1A, it says that it should not include those associations or bodies or persons that have a direct interest in the product. We want to caution that, you know, this will preclude certain industry associations, for example, the Dairy Standards Agency, that has capacity and expertise and has a direct interest in the milk industry. And if you look and read it squarely within the nutshell of what this definition is, it will actually exclude these organizations that have expert services. And speaking about expertise, a colleague of ours earlier on spoke about the qualification of assignees. I think this is a very important matter. And it would be interesting to find out, because we were not given reasons by the department why they revoked the services of Major Mogul and Mpumelelo, whether qualifications had something to do with it. I think it's very critical that, you know, in the consultation processes that we've had with the assignees so far, one of the glooming and glaring concerns that we've had as an industry is that there has not been a demonstration of, you know, an understanding of this industry. We know that this industry is, to a large extent, self-regulatory, and it has done so for a number of years. So it would be really be very crucial that the qualification of the assignees are really scrutinized so that we understand and we know that they are the people that are qualified to do the inspection. And then when I look at Section B, where it talks about audit, we propose that, you know, that there needs to be a lack of clarity as to what is meant by audit. We're not sure whether audits and inspections can actually coexist with each other. We are really saying that let's go for inspections rather than audits, because if now this Act is saying that you're going to need two people or two individuals to perform audits and inspections, which we are concerned that it will further take away up the cost. And then it talks about claims in the very plain sense that these must result with the claims that are associated with the product. We need to understand that that there is no definition of claims. What claims are we talking about? Are we talking about front of labeling? Are we talking about claims of saying this product will give you extra energy or extra, what is it if that is meant by claims? And for that, we would really need to have clarity on that matter. The next section deals with the management control system. I think our colleagues previously have actually spoken to this. We need to clarify the scope and control and the extent to which this management control system will apply. And then we need to make this point that, you know, products that are halal are specific and need certification also need to be included in this category, because we have found through our members that this creates problems when it comes to exports. And therefore, we think that management control should include halal products, it should be clear, and it should also be within the scope of the Act and the relevant regulations. And then there's the definition of sell that's been added there, which includes instances where no consideration is received, that was spoken to earlier on. We need to caution that this needs to be looked very clearly, because one of the challenges of Consumer Protection Act has got to do with food donations. That, you know, the liability of the everybody in the value chain is very prominent, and that we need to make sure that when we talk about sell and how we define it here, that it doesn't encroach and really limit the ability of, you know, producers or retailers or anybody who's involved in this industry from being able to donate food in an environment where food loss and waste is a challenge. The next slide deals with Section 3, which primarily talks about the determination of fees. Firstly, we'd like to say we really are for the cost recovery basis, recovery that has always been in the Act. But, you know, this has always been a challenge to us, because what does it mean when the majority, if not all, of the assignees that are appointed are for-profit companies? How do you, as a for-profit company, actually deliver service on a cost recovery basis when your very business is about being an assignee? You don't have additional businesses. It questions, therefore, and hearing when we're talking about, you were asking questions about consultation previously, I've sat in a number of consultations where fees were presented by assignees, and at no point do the assignees actually reveal in detail their costing, or actually come back at the end of the day, or, you know, or publish their figures so you can able to see what the cost, revenue, or whatever it is. So it's a system that is not transparent, and our assertion here is that there needs to be a regulatory framework that needs to be put in place that will guide the determination of fees. Otherwise, as Zinhle alluded to earlier on, that a number of court cases have resulted in us wasting a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of money, and creating further uncertainties as to the application of the regulations. And it had to do primarily with the fees that are charged by the assignee. And you will note that Section 15 of the Act, and I'll speak to that later on, already makes provision for this regulatory framework to be set in place. And then there is that the executive officer must submit a business plan to the executive officer. Again, without actually being presumptuous or disrespectful, I think it's very important that the Act specifies that the executive officer themselves must have the skills to be able to interrogate those business plans, conflict, because they seem currently to be the judge, jury, and everything, that, you know, it is according to their opinion in terms of who actually should be given the right to actually participate in the process. And that's another area of the act that needs to change, that it cannot be about the opinion only of the executive officer. We understand that the act on behalf of the minister, but the minister must specifically be mentioned in the act to say that they received the business plan. It has to be taken to the minister, and the minister of agriculture must, and I'm going to the next slide here, we are proposing a new section C to say that they need to approve the fees and the budget in concurrence with the Minister of Finance. And if you note that section 15.4 of the current act says that a regulation prescribing fees shall be made with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance. This section has never been actually explored by the department. It is a lever that can actually take us to the next level in terms of creating that certainty that we're looking for as an industry. The portfolio committee would perhaps be aware that there is a similar system in the Department of Forestry, Fisheries and the Environment with the EPR regulations, where the producer responsibility organizations who charge industry fees for waste management. Their fees are determined and then they submit them to the Minister of Finance, and the Minister gets the concurrence of the Minister of Finance, ensuring that just because these agents act on behalf of government, that whatever accounting systems and accountability systems are transparent and are done in line with Treasury rules, so that we know we have certainty in the industry. So we are proposing that we need to have an extra section under Section 3 and Section 3C that deals with the determination of fees, and that we should use the instruments that are already provided for in the Act that allow for the Minister to actually do put this regulatory framework in place, and that the Minister of Finance must be consulted. The other point, which is D there, is that, you know, we need to come to a point where assignees should not come on an annual basis to change their fees. I mean, every 12 months, I think, you know, is unsustainable. Maybe fees should be determined for a period of 3 years, and then they should rise by inflation, so that we don't, as an industry and assignees, on an annual basis have to reach to be determining and approving fees. The next session of 3A deals with the definition of audits and the grading, and we recommend that this should be happen at source to avoid duplication. This point has already been made by our colleagues previously. And then just as I come to my conclusion, we and Zinza alluded to this, it's very important that we really start recognizing, and especially after we listen to the Minister of Finance midterm budget the other day, that we are living in a country that has got dire financial constraints, even from a government perspective, in terms of meeting the objectives of job creation, eliminating poverty and inequality, that the economy is not growing at a rate that it should be growing. And the private sector, and actually I think business and private homes are not really immune to this, that in an environment where there are these challenges, I think it's really critical that the system that has been put in place and has been suggested by Cabinet, that every legislative introduction, amendment, that it should be subjected to CS. It's a few years ago that this year this bill was put into place, and we believe that maybe before we make any recommendations, and the question was asked earlier on, is this bill going to change anything? Are there any disadvantages to it? We would argue that if these submissions are not taken into consideration in terms of fees, in terms of how, you know, these can ultimately affect the consumer, that it may have those implications. So the CS, we believe that it will give an opportunity to look at the impact of this regulation, to ensure that there is consistency among government departments, and also to ensure that, you know, that consumers are not left at a point where they actually bear the brunt at the end of the day. And then we, and this we're saying we're operating in during the time of an administration that is committed to enabling business sustainability by removing a policy impediments and improving the ease of doing business. That they're looking at public policies being evidence-based and effectively coordinated and addressing complicated and lengthy regulatory processes. That's why I'm saying, do we need to every year go and look at the fees, for example? We need to facilitate a country where there's investment. You know, all of this deals about not just import, it's export and import, you know what I'm saying? So it's about how we actually relate with other countries. We as a Consumer Goods Council have participated in this red tape process that has been, that is chaired by this red tape committee, where we submitted some of the legislation that we believe, you know, are not enabling change. And the APS Act is one of those regulations. And therefore, we implore that we should not just simply look at it and say it's amending just definitions. Those definitions, by their implication, you know, down the line have got, you know, consequences not just for business, but also for consumers. That, you know, the SME sector is a very important sector that consideration should also be given to how, you know, it is very difficult for them sometimes to move from SME to actually large scale because of the red tape that is involved throughout the process and the value chain and the enabling and therefore impeding on them actually coming out and blooming and becoming fully fledged. So thank you very much, Chair. I will hand over to Dr. Dinkar. The last slide, which we will share with you, is just a summary of what we've actually emphasized today to say that the definition of assigning the management control system should be interrogated, that there needs to be an audit of the of whether there is still a need for assignees given the measure of the department, that the powers of the executive officer should be looked at so that, you know, the involvement of both ministers of government and finance actually become a feature and a permanent one, given the fact that, and I'm going to follow to the point for that section 54 of the APS Act already creates a framework where both ministers can actually assist in actually determining the fees. That we need to, before this amendment is passed, that we consider its implications and its economic to the increment by conducting SCS, so that we can minimize unintended consequences, that, you know, we facilitate, that we really implore the committee to please facilitate that process that has been established by the president of eliminating red tape. And if the industry says that this is one of the legislation that really has got the effect of impeding on its sustainability, let's hear that and then let's explore this further. And then there needs to be a separation of powers, because sometimes we talk about issues of safety, sometimes we talk about issues of quality, that the role of DALRAT and the role of the National Department of Health should actually be made clear. Thank you very much, Chair, and we'll hand over back to you.
Thank you, Chairperson, for this opportunity. We'd like to hand over back to you. However, that's just a final point. We just want to implore the committee to consider that the policy and the regulatory environment should create an enabling environment for businesses to strive and should not be creating all of these regulatory frameworks that are an impediment for success. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Honorable members. That was the presentation by the Consumer Goods Council of South Africa, presented to us by Zinhle Kike, and I'm tempted to say Tiger's Eye. If we may correct that so that it makes it easy for the chairperson to identify the presenters with their proper names, instead of having Tiger's Eye on a parliamentary session. Let's move on, honorable members, and invite Primario to make their submission. That is going to be led by John Oxenham,
as well as Ntate Christopher Clifton. You may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson. Just a change in the presenter. I'm Anthony Stain. I've been briefed by Primerio. I'm a member of the Johannesburg Bar Senior Council to present this presentation to this honourable committee. Can I ask, Mr. Chairperson, firstly, can you hear me effectively?
Yes, we can hear you clearly. You may go ahead.
Thank you very much. So my name is Anthony Stain, A-N-T-H-O-N-Y-S-T-E-I-N. I'm briefed by Primerio, which is a law firm. Mr. Clifton is on the call, is on the presentation. And we, as you know, Mr. Chairperson, represent Premier Foods, Premier FCMG. And I'm going to ask my team, please, to share our screen. I believe that we haven't yet been afforded permission, Mr. Chairperson.
Mr. Stain is a coach. He can share the presentation.
If you could share it with Mr.
You have been enabled to be a co-host. You may proceed and share the document.
Yes, but if you don't mind, Mr. Chair, if you could share, if I could ask your secretariat to share with Ms. Gina Lodolo, who is controlling the presentation.
Okay, Chair.
The presentation should come up.
Okay.
Ugina Lodolo.
Lodolo.
Yes. Can you also assist the Tiger's Eye to change their name into their proper name so it can make it easier for identification purposes?
Mr. Chairperson, you should now, and all the members of your Honourable Committee, see the presentation.
Yes, we can see the presentation. If you can make it into slide mode, that we can be able to just see the slide on the screen, we'll appreciate that.
Yes, I think that should be done now. Is that better, Mr. Chairperson?
Yes, you may proceed.
Thank you very much. Mr. Chairperson, just by way, if I could ask to go to the second slide. By way of introduction, just something of a background as to who Premier is. And Premier is a large private company that is involved in the manufacture, distribution, marketing, and marketing of branded private label fast-moving consumer goods in South Africa. Of particular relevance to the grain industry, Premier's primary commercial activities relate to milling, both wheat and maize milling, and to baking. And in this regard, the committee may be interested to be aware that Premier produces, for example, over 538 million loaves of bread every year from its various bakeries situated in nine provinces. And that makes Premier one of the largest suppliers of bread in South Africa. In relation to milling, Premier has 7 wheat and 3 maize mills with a total capacity of about 763,000 tons, and about 500,500 tons of maize every year. So Premier is a very significant participant in this industry and in the market, and a very significant economic contributor in South Africa. If we can move on then to the substance of our comments, and thank you again for the opportunity, Mr. Chairperson and your committee. I want to, if you don't mind, ask a summary of what our substantive representations of the Act on the bill, on the proposed bill, will be. The first is that Premier commented on the definition of an assignee, as it is sought to be amended by the bill. and has cautioned that the definition is under-inclusive. And I'll explain to you, Mr. Chairperson and the members of the committee, what we mean by that in certain material respects, and that it therefore creates certain potential inconsistencies with other provisions of the Act. Second, Premier commented on the introduction of the certain defined terms in the Act, and I'm going to, in particular, address your committee on certain specific defined terms. One of them is the definition of the term audit. The other is the definition of the term as opposed to inspection in the existing Act and in the proposed amendment. The second is of the seminal term, the management control system. And then thirdly, in particular, of the term cell. In addition to that, if we can move then to slide 4. Premier, and we'll address the committee on the new provision thought to be introduced in the bill regarding the calculation of the assignee fees on a cost recovery basis. Of course, as I think all of the presenters have remarked, the principle of cost recovery is a necessary and a welcome one, but there are certain aspects of it which we will, I hope, point out to you are inconsistent and present certain possible problems. And then finally, we would like to suggest that the bill misses an opportunity for introducing safeguards and detailed provisions for the exercise of assigning powers. And you'll appreciate in this regard that the assigning function is a very particular function. The assignee is effectively exercising the powers ultimately of the minister through the executive officer, and therefore performs fundamental public powers, and is doing so as a private entity, and therefore we submit that it is important that there be very careful safeguards around the exercise of these powers. So then if I may move on to the first of our comments. The present Act, as it stands, has a definition of assignee. The bill seeks to amend the definition by including a qualification about a quality or feature of an assignee, namely that the assignee does not have a direct or an indirect interest in the product concerned. That, of course, we would wholly endorse, and it's of absolute importance. It would be intolerable if there was a situation where a private body exercising public powers had some sort of interest in the regulatory objects that they were exercising powers over. But we say to the committee that the introduction of this single feature, this single qualification, is unhelpful because it's under-inclusive. It creates a definition of assignee which is not consistent with other parts of the Act as it stands. And we refer you, for example, to Section 2(3)(a) of the Act. Your committee will appreciate in that regard, for example, that the existing Act requires that the assignee must have existing necessary skill, experience, knowledge of the sector into which they are being introduced as an assignee. And so Premier proposes that the definition must be enhanced to expand the definition of an assignee to include that the assignee must have the existing necessary skill, experience, resources, and importantly, the infrastructure to carry out its function, and that the definition should stipulate that it must be also a juristic person. And we say that because for purposes of continuity, so that there is no interruption, as would be the case in the case of a natural person. We also say to the committee that it should preferably be an entity with a controlling interest in South Africa, in other words, a South African entity, because it is regulating a sector of the South African economy, and
it must be effectively, it must effectively fall under the laws of South Africa and other regulatory systems within South Africa. So we emphasize particularly the need for this existing experience, skill, and infrastructure. And I'll return to that later, because there is a real difficulty if the case arises where an assignee is appointed and uses the opportunity as an assignee to develop skills or to develop infrastructure. That has enormous cost implications which are unrelated to its assigned regulatory function under the Act. And we would say that not only is that unnecessary and disappointing, but it would have legal consequences in terms of subjecting the Act to a vulnerability of legal challenge. So if I could then move on to the second comment that we have on the proposed bill. And at this point, I begin to address the panel on certain definitional aspects. The first is that the bill seeks to introduce the defined term audit and to amend the definition of a management control system by inserting a new provision in the form of section 2(3)(a), Roman numeral 2. And we say that the combined effect of all of this will be problematic when it comes to interpreting the bill outside in the real world. The first point we make is that it's not clear what the purpose of the audit function is, as distinct and separate from the inspection function, which remains undefined in the bill. So the committee will appreciate that as it stands, inspection is a central operative term in the bill. And inspection is, in the existing Act, and inspection is not defined in the Act, but it performs a central role. So that would leave it up to courts to interpret what is meant and what the scope is of an inspection. But now the bill seems to introduce an additional term, and that is the audit function. The bill does define what an audit is, but the inspection role, the inspection function, remains undefined in the proposed bill. So we say that this will give rise to an interpretive confusion if it's allowed to stand in that way. It would be preferable for these terms to be clearly defined so that the exact scope of the one in relation to the other is clearly understood and interpreted. And it may in fact be only necessary to have one or the other, unless it is there is something specific and technical that the legislature intends to communicate by the term audit as opposed to the term inspection. We then say it appears that the envisaged audit of the management control systems is intended to ensure that the product aligns with the description provided to the market or the consumer. So we say there that while it's understandable that in terms of the object of the Act, that the Act's fundamental purpose is to ensure that the product is what it says on the tin. It isn't a part of the purpose of the Act as we understand it, that it should be aimed at issues such as consumer health and safety, because those things are governed by other legislation. And in this regard, the envisaged audit of a management control system as it's defined at the moment may lead to confusion as to whether this is a genuine purpose of the Act or if it encroaches on one of the other potential objects which are contained in other legislation such as consumer protection legislation. The other point that is important to make in relation to this is that it appears that the bill envisages an additional or a separate assignee to conduct the function of auditing these management control systems related to the product. And we say in this regard that it's not clear why or what the scope of this assignee is in relation to other assignees that may be appointed for the purposes of grading and so on. And if it is the case that there is intended to be a second type of assignee appointed, well, we suggest that this is an unnecessary duplication, that the assignee appointed should be capable of performing both of these functions. It's unnecessary that it should be a separate assignee. This only adds to significant cost and administrative duplication in the regulatory system. If I could ask them to move on to the next slide. Finally, in respect to the question of definitions as they're contained in the Act with the Chairman and members of the committee, we draw your attention to the way that cell has been defined in the proposed bill. And in particular, the one feature that worries us is that it includes within the definition of cell that a sale or to sell is include both disposal for a consideration or not for a consideration or otherwise. And we say in this regard that this may raise significant difficulties, particularly where there are donations, for example, without consideration. And in particular, amongst other possible difficulties in this regard, this may have a significant impact on the application of the regulatory scheme to the informal economy. So we suggest that a narrower definition of the term cell is the more appropriate one, given the entities over which regulation is intended to be exerted. If we could move on to the next slide. The next important topic that we address you on in respect of the bill is that the Section 3.1 capital B, as it is now, seeks to introduce a method for fee determination which is calculated on a cost recovery basis. And we emphasize again that the principle that fees charged by an assignee in particular should be based on cost recovery is a fundamental and important one. It bears pausing at this point to emphasize why that is the case. As we've mentioned in our written submission to the committee, the fundamental role of an assignee is to exercise a public power. It wouldn't be a tolerable policy choice, and it would almost certainly be vulnerable to challenge on various grounds were the assignee to use the opportunity to regulate as a business opportunity, not to exercise its powers purely on a cost recovery basis. So we welcome, of course, the principle that the assignee's fees and the exercise of the assignee's powers should be on a cost recovery basis. But there are a number of concerns in addition to this. The first of these is that it's unclear to us whether the process outlined in this section is intended to be in addition to and following the mandatory of the fee determined in terms of another section in the Act as it stands, Section 3.1 capital A. So as it's presently proposed, there will be a business plan that is published for comments by interested parties. And I'll come to the definition of those interested parties in a moment. But the committee will be aware that under the existing provision, which is Section 3.1 capital A, the presentation of the methodology and the fees by an assignee is already subject to the requirements of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. And as the courts have emphasized repeatedly, and in any event, as the Act and the Constitution require, those fees, as published, and that methodology must follow a notice and comment type process, and that is invariably the kind of process that has been followed by the department and under its auspices the assignee. Now, the difficulty that we have in reading the bill as it stands is it's unclear to us whether this proposed publication of the business plan for comment by interested parties is intended to supplant the existing notice and comment PADGER process. And if that is the case, then that, we suggest, would give rise to difficulties. So it, in our submission, should be made clear that this opportunity to comment on the business plan as the assignee presents it is a separate process, and it's not one that substitutes for the other requirements of procedural fairness under the Act as it stands. The second aspect that we point out to you about this new section 3.1 capital B is that it provides for the executive officer, as it currently reads, to determine in his opinion, in his or her opinion, it should say, who is directly affected by the actions of the assignee. So the section, as it currently stands, provides that the business plan will be published for comment, but only to those whom the executive officer determined in his opinion as a direct interest and is therefore permitted to make comments. And we say that this would be fundamentally in conflict with the constitutional requirements of procedural fairness, but also the well-established principles of procedural fairness that provide that all interested parties are provided with an opportunity to comment, not those only that the executive officer determined should be eligible for comment. So in other words, what we are saying is that the test for whether a party should be permitted to make comments on the proposed business plan should not be whether it is in the opinion of the executive officer that they have an interest, but rather whether they objectively have an interest. It can't be that it is a subjective determination, because if it is, that will lead to a proliferation of challenges and of litigation as being directly in conflict with well-established constitutional principles and with, as we have indicated, not only the decided cases in respect of procedural fairness in other areas, but the decided cases to which the committee has already been referred in relation specifically to the exercise of powers under the APS Act. And finally, in respect of this aspect of cost recovery, we say that the bill provides, as it stands, that it should be approved within a stipulated time. And we say that it would be more satisfactory if Parliament stipulated precisely that time, and that should not exceed a period of 12 months. And the reason for this is, we say, a fairly sensible one, and that is that if a period of more than 12 months is allowed to elapse, well, then fundamental aspects relating to a business plan are likely to have changed. And so the relevant consideration to the approval of a business plan that may be applicable within a period of 12 months is likely to fundamentally alter if the period is allowed to run for a longer period. Of course, there can be debate about what that precise period is. We suggest that 12 months is a reasonable one. There may be other reasonable periods, but what we do strongly submit is that it should be a fixed and specific period. And if it hasn't been approved within that period, well, then the business plan, the assignee, as the case may be, must be required to present a new business plan for approval and for comment. If I may ask us to move then to the next slide, slide 9. So finally, what we say, and this relates to what I mentioned at the outset, Mr. Chairperson, is that the assigning is exercising an important public power. And it's a public power that constitutionally falls initially under the powers of the minister, who may then effectively delegate it to the executive officer, and in turn, who may appoint an assignee. The assignee is invariably a private body. It has no history or necessary competence in regulatory exercise of power. And so it's important, we say, as a matter of principle, that there be strong safeguards in place for the monitoring of not only how the assignee intends to initiate the powers, but how it exercises those powers on an ongoing basis. And so we suggest that this bill is an opportunity to strengthen those safeguards over the exercise of powers by the assignee. Firstly, for the oversight and direction of the executive officer, as the Act stands at the moment, it simply provides that the assignee must exercise its powers under the oversight and direction of the executive officer. But in our experience, or the experience of our clients in this industry, invariably the assignee undertakes a vast range of exercise of powers without interaction with the executive officer or oversight. And so we say there should be more specificity and detail in respect of how that oversight and direction is exercised. Then we also suggest that where there is provision for the appointment of an assignee, in order to safeguard the commercial and competition aspects of that, it would be preferable for there to be more than one assignee, or at least the possibility of appointing more than one assignee in respect of inspections and testing of a particular sector, such as grains and grain products. And then finally, we say that the board should expressly take into account and require that the executive officer take into consideration the functions currently performed by the industry. The industry and the players in the industry are, by and large, we would submit on behalf of our clients, extremely technically capable and well-established, and by and large are very conscious of the need for accurate grading and testing, and have developed detailed systems for that purpose. And so in order to avoid both duplication of functions and, of course, cost implications, we say that the bill should make provision that in appointing an assignee, it should be necessary to take into account these important and established practices that already and capabilities that already exist within the industry. So, Mr. Chairperson, those in compartments are our submissions regarding the bill as it stands. We thank you for the opportunity to make our representation. Perhaps by way of just a closing comment, to emphasise that the powers that are exercised by the assignee, where assignees are appointed, are public powers. And it is a matter of concern to the industry and to our clients that the assignee be held to a standard where those powers, where an assignee is appointed, are exercised responsibly and consistently and in a way that is rational and cost-effective. Because the alternative to that is that what are in effect regulatory powers are being exercised in a manner that is not for the purpose of regulation, but for ulterior purposes, such as to develop the assignee business or infrastructure opportunities, or indeed, as is the case with certain assignees at present, to make some kind of income for themselves, and in fact to pass on that income to bodies that aren't necessarily even South African bodies, to shareholders that may be foreign-based shareholders, for example. All of these safeguards are very important to bear in mind, and the bill provides an opportunity for the legislature to enhance these safeguards. We thank the portfolio committee for its time, and to you, Mr. Chairperson, for hearing us, and we will stand by for any questions that your committee may have.
Thank you, and just saying, these honourable members, Mr. Anthony Stain, making a submission on behalf of Primaria. We will now take our last presentation, which will be a submission from SAOSA, that being South African Organic Sector Organization. They would also be with the Participatory Guarantee System South Africa. Let me invite honorable members Brett Sander as well as Botshabelo Mabunda. You are most welcomed, and you may please go ahead with the presentation.
Good morning. Sorry, I'm moving. Hi, Brett Sander from SAOSA. We're just moving from engagement quickly. Botshabelo, I'm not sure if she's on the call. Yes, we've asked for our presentation. Colleen, if you could share that, please. Or if the administration does have that, we have a presentation that would...
Sia is going to bring that presentation up now, Brett.
Thank you.
Can I ask that I be made co-host so I can share the presentation? Thank you.
Brett, this is a parliament session we are having, which is being streamed to other media outlets. Please settle down in a quiet corridor so that we don't pick up the other noise in the corridor.
Apologies for that.
And we're just waiting for co-host permission to be given to Sia Bonga so that she can share the presentation. Thank you. This is a joint presentation being made by the South African Organic Sector Organization and CGS South Africa. We're approaching this very much along the path of organic certification and labeling of organic produce for consumers. So that is the perspective that we would like to give in this presentation. I hope Brett is in a quiet space and he can proceed. Thank you.
Thank you, Colleen. Apologies for that, colleagues, and apologies, Chair. Yes, I'm talking today on behalf of the SAOSA South African Organic Sector Organization. SAOSA was formed about just over two decades ago and was finalized and formalized as a voluntary association in 2009. We recently registered as the MPC and are deficiently recognize organic sector bodies. The mandate really emanates from the Fridge study, which was conducted in 2008 and has really given guidance on how the development and rollout of the South African organic sector should look and the support that should be given towards the the sector. We have been pushing hard to get the SAWASO standard recognized, and I've been through the process recently with SABS, which we will get into. And that process has got us as a member of the IFOM Organics International, and our standard as a recognized international standard under the IFOM body of standards for organic agriculture. We are the custodian of the standards and have currently started implementing through private inspection and audit bodies such as Control Union the delivery of that standard in the local context. For us, this is probably the main challenge. Please, next slide. Is that the delivery of the organic agriculture in the local context, especially with SAWASO, has been strongly around emerging farmers and support of emerging farmers and offering a different approach in terms of agricultural production, ideally with least or less costs and a more healthy output. And those emerging farmers are the ones that are least able to afford the audit and certification process. And that has led to the development of the PGS system, which is the peer guarantee system, which is a globally recognized system of peer-to-peer, so normally farmer-to-farmer, including consumers and retailers attending a farm visit. And in that process, through using the SAWASO standards and the documentation provided as a benchmark to establish that a producer or a manufacturer is compliant towards the standards through a joint participation process. For us, this has led to a much quicker adoption of the SAWASO, or the South African standard for organic agriculture. And we hope that such mechanisms are allowed for within the bill, even within the local context. A lot of the international perspective, which I will go through now, has shown that the allowing mechanisms such as peer guarantee systems to develop the farmer base and to bring a recognized standard closer to the under or the less matured farmer is a complete necessity, and to increase competitiveness of those farmers as well as to increase quality and quantity of production, those systems also add a lot of co-learning and experience sharing, which farmers find most beneficial and consumers and customers can really get involved in. So for us, we look at it from a very two-pronged view, that we require both, yes, the formal audited certifying that's currently happening through certification bodies or appointed implementers, as well as a communal or localized system that would encourage the emergence of organic smallholder farmers and allow for the development of our agrarian our agrarian economy at a different level to commercial pesticide and agrochemical heavy production. Our five core objectives are currently the slide. Sorry, Colleen, can you maybe just go back to the last slide? I just want to go over the iPhone quickly. Yeah, so as I was mentioning, SAWASO forms part of the iPhone family of standards, which are all the global recognized standards. The EU standard, etc., would all be part of that iPhone family of standards. And the SAWASO standard currently is recognized within those body of standards. We are currently going through the process with SABS to have that standard recognized and regulated under the SABS provisions. And that
okay, just to continue where Brett has left off, sorry, I hope we haven't lost him completely. So we are going through a process of harmonizing the two sets of standards in South Africa for the local market. Being in the ISOAM family of standards means that there is a degree of equivalence, so that the standards are recognized internationally. The Sawasoo standard actually came up very highly on the COROS International Assessment of Organic Standards, in that the section on biodiversity and social justice were a lot higher than the international norms. Next slide, please, dear. So yes, I think we've gone through this briefly. These are our five core objectives as the organic sector, basically trying to develop the organization to create a knowledge hub for farmers that they can learn how to adopt organic agriculture, and to look at access to markets for the smallholder farmer through participatory guarantee systems. So participatory guarantee systems is actually a management control system, and that is why we would like, that is what we are aiming here, is to have participatory guarantee systems recognized. Fourthly, we work a lot in networks. We have to. There are a lot of people in the network that are trying to support farmers who are looking to farm sustainably, and of course to advocate and lobby for the organic sector. Next slide, please. Yeah, thank you. So the work that we do aligns with the African Union EOAI initiative. This was a decision that was taken in 2010 to support farmers who are often being exploited. The basic core objectives of the EOAI is similar, very similar to what it also aims to do. So we can say that we align very well with what the African Union is doing, and that is in research and training, information communication, value chain market development, networking and partnerships, policy and program development, and then institutional capacity development. Thanks, Sia. So yes, we work hand in hand. So also is the holder of the organic standards, but we work with Participatory Guarantee Systems South Africa to implement the standards on the ground. So PGSSA is a way of bringing farmers together to work together so that they can aggregate their produce and actually become market ready for the organic market. So there is the need for transparency, and the labeling of PGS produce is essential for consumers to understand. And yeah, we collaborate again on areas around training and things like that. Thank you. So we've spoken already about the harmonization of the standards. One of our projects is that Sawasoo is the South African node of the Knowledge Hub for Organic Agriculture in South Africa, in Southern Africa. It is actually one of five hubs throughout Africa, and we work with organizations in Southern Africa to promote organic agriculture through the development of research and what we call knowledge products. Through this project, we have been able to do quite a lot to expand PGS activity in South Africa, and we have trained a number of what we call PGS pollinators to go out to start groups of farmers and to get them working to the standards so that they can label their produce as organic. Thanks, Sia. So just to reinforce what the certification landscape means in the organic sector. So we have what is known as a first-party claim, and that is where a farmer or a producer directly engages with the consumer, and the consumer is happy to believe their claim that their produce is organic. Second-party certification is the PGS system. Here, farmers want recognition. They're actually producing enough. They have surplus. They want to sell it into the market. And they want to be recognized for their organic practices. And, of course, it's responding to the consumer needs. For the consumers looking for assurance that the produce is grown organically. I think the demand for this has greatly increased since COVID emerged and the recognition that nutrition, nutritional value of food is important when it comes to developing a strong immunity. So the third party certification is, I think, what we're all aware of, where we have an independent accredited certifying body that comes in to review the processes and confirms that the product is verified as being organic. This is an expensive third party certification, can be very expensive. ACPs don't come cheaply. And so this is why in South Africa, we have been supporting second party assurance through the PGS process. Thank you. So this in a nutshell is how the PGS process works. It's a group of stakeholders that get together, and those stakeholders include farmers, consumers, retailers or markets, and they meet every annually on a farm. They go through the management control system. They verify that the practices of the farmer are indeed organic, and at the end of that visit, they either give the farmer organic certification or possibly in conversion status that will allow the farmer to reap the benefits of his sustainable farming practices. Thanks, Neil. So the dots on the map, we're looking to expand. These are where PGS groups have begun. They have been seeded there. Many of them are market ready now and taking produce to market as organic produce. We're hoping, I think there's currently around about 350 farmers in the PGS network, but as I say, it's growing exponentially. There is so much interest and demand from farmers. Thanks, yeah. So this is some of the other things that we're looking to prioritize, is getting the logos out on the shelf and getting more producers certified to the standard for the local market. It is only by getting farmers market ready in the local market that they can become ready for export. It's not something that can happen overnight. It's something that the farmers have to work towards. But as a group, there is a lot more potential that once a group of farmers have managed to market their goods on the local market, that they can then transition to the next step of export. Of course, we need a trade desk as well, benefit producers and trade. We do have a relationship with the Agricultural Research Council. There's big demand. There's a huge need for research to demonstrate the benefits of organic agriculture, not only with respect to yield, but also with respect to the drought resistance of local seeds. We're part of the ISAN network. ISAN is the IFOAM Southern African Network that consists of countries in the SADC region, and we work together as a network to try and support what we do. One of the other things that we find is a real challenge is the registration of organic input in the registrar's office at 36. This is a real challenge for organic farmers. The length of time and the cost associated with registering organic input is far out of reach for a number of local producers who want to support organic farmers. Next slide, Tisia. Yes, we keep on pushing the networks that we're in, and we have to, because the work that we aim to do in South Africa to support the smallholder farmers is immense. And as the sector body, we cannot do all of the work ourselves. So the next slide is just showing you what our logos look like. We have two sets of logos. This is really third-party certified. These are the logos that have been trademarked. There is a PGS certified and an organic certified, and the latter being certification for that is done by accredited certifying body. The next set of seals are those that are given to farmers who have demonstrated that they have farmed organically. And as I said, this is done on farm visits. At the moment, the cost of undertaking these farm visits has been subsidized by our funders, and that is GIZ. So we can reward the pollinators to go out and do these farm visits. That is, in fact, the only cost associated with a farmer being able to take his produce to market as organic. So the cost compared to third-party certification are greatly reduced. So moving on to the specific comments in the bill, yes, we read this very much referencing organic regulation. And we would like to know where we stand with the regulation, because there was a document put out in 2008 regulating the control of the sale of organically produced products, but I don't believe it was ever passed. And we understand that these regulations were replaced by the SANS 1369 organic standard. And in the standard, references are made to participatory guarantee systems under three, the definitions, which in the next slide we go into in a little bit more detail. So PGS, participatory guarantee systems, also called guarantee schemes or PGS. It's a system among a small group of smallholder farmers who produce products for the local market. They share a common objective with third-party certification systems that are run by accredited certification bodies by providing a credible guarantee to consumers who seek organic products. So PGS are locally focused quality assurance systems that serve particular markets, and they are built on the foundation of trust, social networks, and knowledge exchange. It's very much adapted to the local market and so short supply chains. You can't have PGS produce going through long supply chains where there are a number of hands that produce pass through, as the integrity of that supply chain is then reduced. But PGS do enable the direct participation of producers, consumers, and other stakeholders in the development and implementation of verification and the review and decision process that is followed to recognize farmers as producers of organic food. It allows for a much more intensive interaction between the farmer and the guarantee organization, and uses tools other than those that are used by third-party certification bodies to maintain integrity. They integrate capacity building and allow farmers and reviewers to help solve practical problems. And this is very, very apparent when you go on farm visits, because what happens is that there's a number of farmers on the visit and they can talk, they can guide the other farmers. They can say, well, these are the problems that I've experienced and this is how I dealt with them. So there's true knowledge exchange that takes place during the process of a PGS visit. And it's very much a process that is owned by the stakeholders in the community. And it does encourage farmers to take responsibility and result in their active involvement in the design of production and certification processes. Thank you. So here, when we talk about assignees, we ask the question, it states, which does not have direct or indirect interest in the product concern. So we wanted to know what the definition of indirect interest would be. So would other members of the PGS group be considered as having an indirect interest in the product? Would they be seen as independent enough to be able to act? Next slide, please. So again, just reinforcing the note that the audit is a systematic and functionally independent examination of the management control system. So yes, we would like to hear about whether the PGS audit process would be considered functionally independent. Thanks, Ian. Yeah. So once again, just reinforcing the notion that we are talking about labeling here for organic produce. So we're talking about a word on a product that indicates that the product is indeed organic. And the labeling is currently in use. The seals for PGS produce can be found on shelves, and it is generally recognized for the local markets in South Africa. And this is with respect to the assignee, designating an assignee, a person undertaking body, institution, association, or board, having a particular knowledge in respect of the product concerned. So here we would like to know whether the minister would designate PGS South Africa as the body having a particular knowledge around management control systems in the organic sector. So thank you very much for the opportunity. We have not had the opportunity of being consulted prior to this, so we really value the opportunity. Here is some information to contact us should you wish to find out more about the work that we do in trying to develop smallholder farmers to get into the organic sector so that they can label their produce as organic produce. Thank you very much.
Apologies, Chair. I know I had technical difficulties, and thank you, Colleen, for jumping in and doing the presentation. Maybe just one point to add on is for us, the repercussions, and as Colleen has stated, the Act 36, the Act 36 and the requirements for organic input to be certified within our standard and with all organic standards around the world, we also require for the inputs to be certified organic. And in our South African context, this is something else that needs to be looked at, is that our current waste management systems, our current inputs into organic agriculture, our microbial, our biological inputs, all need to have a very similar system aligned to them, as well as municipal systems, waste management systems, so we can actually have the capacity to follow through on organic or regenerative agricultural practices under whatever management system control emanates from this new bill, in order for the organic regenerative space to have any capacity to grow. So we also need to look at some of the details that would emanate from the use of such standards and what that would require in terms of value chain assistance. And just in terms of creating these bills, understand the cost implications to producers if we make that tool erroneous. Thank you.
Thank you, honorable members. There's the presentations having been put to us by the South African Organic Sector Organization and the Participatory Guarantee Systems South Africa. Let's welcome all the presentations from the various stakeholders, including Primerio and the Consumer Goods Council of South Africa. We will now open the sessions for questions of clarity or comments on the presentations before the committee. Honorable Tlhapi. She did indicate that she was gonna hop on to another meeting of Section 94. Honorable Tlhapi, are you with us? If not, we'll move on. Honorable Masiba.
Thank you, Chair. Thanks to Ms. Winkler, Dr. Anthony, and Bryce. Chair, just starting with the consumer, what's the name now again? Sorry, Consumer Good Council.
Chair, I just want to make sure I understand their submission clearly. So in terms of their submissions, there's three things that I'm picking up. Is that there is obviously a concern around the socio-economic impact assessment that was not done. So, and obviously this would imply that they need to look at, you know, whether this is necessary, the bill is necessary, and obviously understanding that we are in a very, very economic difficulties. This bill obviously introduces more cost and creates more bad taste and all this kind of stuff. That's one. And the second one, there is an element that they brought to the fore, which pertains to whether there is really a need to appoint this assignee, because the Department of Agriculture and Land Reform and Rural Development should, in essence, have the capacity to carry some of the tasks. So the request is one that an investigation needs to be done there to understand what is the capacity of the department. And lastly, Chair, in their submission is that obviously then they make some proposal. So I think the question for me is, which one really did they opt for, really, in terms of sequence, what needs to be done? Are they looking for more public participation to ensure that issues of socioeconomic impact are assessed properly? And obviously do audit in terms of the capacity of the department, and then obviously if there is really a need, then the department can look in terms of amending the bill. So I just want to be clear about that, but I've seen that they have made also some submission with regards to how the changes need to happen with regards to the bill. Chair, and I must say also just this, that, you know, looking at the number of court cases that the department has had to lose in court, it just worries me, and it should worry us as a committee, that the department seems to not really even care about losing cases and pushing through things that are constitutionally delinquent, if you want to call it that way. So that is really just a point of concern from my side. Coming to Premier, I think Premier has really done a good job in terms of analyzing the bill, and I must be honest, from where I sit, I think I understand the bill much clearer and in terms of its concern, its issues. So my feel is that with the Premier's presentation, they have highlighted the issues, but they haven't really given us the solution to these issues that have been highlighted. But at the end of the day, the issues that they are raising is that they are obviously procedurally, you know, make this bill, call it unconstitutional, or it will not pass the constitutional muster. It needs to be reviewed. So I think the question for me is that to the Premier is that do you suggest that the bill get back to consultation process with the industry, or make additional amendments to the bill for consideration for us to look at? If I can get that clarity there. Since the organic produce was quite clear, Chair, I have no questions of clarity there. Thanks very much.
Honorable Dr. Masipa, the Honorable Kappa. Tim. Velaz. Pao Kappa. Remember, the Honorable Memato. Honorable Briet.
Hi, Chairperson. From my side, I don't have any questions. Just welcoming the presentations. I think they were very clear, and I would like to agree with Honourable Masipa that it would I would have liked from Premier to actually see suggestions as to improvements that can be made. Thanks.
Thank you, Honourable Briet. The Honourable Memakati. The Honourable Memakati. Okay, the last, the Honourable Balkaba.
Thank you, Chair. I'm sorry for this. The technology was just being unfair to me. But now, just one clarity, Honourable Chair, on this part of organic farming. I would like to know whether now in the bill, as far as they are concerned, what would be the relation between the organic farming, which seems to be known as 100% organic, and the indigenous knowledge systems, which in my understanding may not be 100% organic, but to a great extent may be organic, because the problem is that sometimes organic takes too long to make the returns. But in my understanding, the indigenous knowledge systems, to a great extent, has been organic until the situation has changed. What would be the link between the two, and also in a way that would make this non-discriminatory, so that maybe if there are those who may be going 60, 70, 80% organic, there's still a benefit in this process. I thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Kapa. That is the question for the Honorable Sebekulu.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. Greetings to you and all members. And thanking the presenters with the presentation that I've made. I think Chairperson myself too, I don't have a question or comment on the presentation that have been made, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Sebekulu. The Honorable Ntate Matias. Ntate Matias. The Honorable Ntate Kruger. Paul Kruger.
Hello, Jay. Thank you, Jay. I'm covered. Thank you, Jay.
Thank you, Honorable Memakati. Honorable Memakati. Any other honourable member on the platform who may wish to pose a question or comment on the presentation?
Yes, Jim.
Yes, Member Kazi.
Apologies for not coming through when you called in. Chair, I wanted to make, just to ask two questions to the first presenters of the second round of presentations. There was an indication from them relating to the capacity of the department in as far as assessors are concerned. I want to check with them if their request is not an overreach in terms of what the executive is expected to do. Of course, there would have been challenges in relation to capacity previously. That's why there was an appointment of the two individuals that were referred to. But for us to really want to question and go beyond questioning and insist on an audit being done, in as far as assessors are concerned, I just want to find out from them, don't they think it's an overreach and is an administrative matter that the department can handle on its own without going taking such severe measures? Secondly, there was an issue relating to regulations and powers given to the executive. And in their presentation, I'm not sure whether it was in their input, but all on the presentation, so where they made reference to industries that would want to be part of the regulatory process, given their expertise and so forth and so on. And they make reference to the dairy market, to be precise. From their view, don't they think it's equally an overreach on a basis... Am I still on the platform?
Yes, you're on the platform, Honorable Member Shati. Can I request, before you proceed, everyone to mute their microphones? Thank you. Proceed, Member Shati.
Thank you, Chair. My question with regards to the second portion was that if we are to bring, you know, the big guns of the industry into their regulatory processes, are they not playing a referee and a player all at once? Why would you want to bring somebody who is in the market, who is in the industry, to come and assist in regulating the same industry that they are involved in? Irrespective of the market, irrespective of the expertise that they have. Because in actual fact, this amendment are meant to transform these industries to make sure that we advance and bring your small, medium enterprises to the fore. But the reference based on expertise, which will equally mean that those who've been in the market for quite some time and most probably have been monopolizing the market will be the one playing a fundamental role in regulating the market itself. So I just wanted to find out those two elements. Maybe on the second presenter, there was an issue about inconsistency in the amendment. Chair, can maybe legal services on this particular aspect assist us to assess and analyze whether there are those inconsistencies, and if they are, how material are they? Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Mem Ashati. The Honorable Mem Asho. Or any other honorable member on the platform who may wish to pose a question or comment whom I've not been able to recognize?
Thank you, Chairperson.
Honorable Mamutu Ekde.
Thank you, Chair. I will be very quick, seemingly. When it comes to network, it's not my day today. I will be very quick, Chair. Actually, it's not a... It's not a question, Chair, but a comment. I would like to caution everybody, more especially the stakeholders that are presenting. We are presenting on the legislation matter. Therefore, Chair, they need to stick to that. And once you start... I would, in the lack of a better word, Chair, I would use overlapping or, yes, overlapping to another sphere that is not within what you're supposed to be presenting on. It might create problems. As much as the committee, we really appreciate
the inputs and the suggestions, also suggested solutions. We need to be, I don't want to use the word genuine, we need to be very much in line with what we are seeking to achieve. In that note, Chair, I agree with Honorable Mahlatsi. There's an element of overlapping from the legislation that we are seeking to, from the bill that we are seeking to amend, to overlapping to administration matters. Can we refrain and stick to what we are here for, Chair? Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Mamotrete. Any other honorable member whom I have not recognized who may wish to have a question? Honorable Ntate Masipa, is that a follow-up or extra question?
Chair, thanks. Yeah, it's just a word of caution to our colleagues that this is a participatory process where the members of the industry are making input to the legislation, and we cannot be prescriptive as to how they need to make this particular input. I think it's very important, Chair, and I think you need to make a ruling, because tomorrow we cannot be calling this industry expert to give us input if we are telling them that they mustn't go there. You know, so I think, Chair, you've got to make a proper ruling.
Honorable members, I think I should refer you back to the agenda and purpose of the day. We are receiving submissions on the Agricultural Product Standards Amendment Bill. That's what the purpose of today is. Now, we've opened the session for industry players and stakeholders to be able to make their submission on the bill, not on the department or any other work of the department, but on the bill. So the honorable members are within their rights to make comments that they feel is going outside the mandate of what this bill speaks to. But in any case, the stakeholders are here. They can speak for themselves and they can be able to respond to the issues raised by the honorable members. I will therefore take this opportunity to invite the stakeholders who have presented for responses. We'll go accordingly as in how the presentations were put to the committee. Let me invite Mamos Zinhle from the Consumer Goods Council of South Africa. Please proceed.
Who are going to be responding? Who are going to be responding now? Mumudu.
Mamos Zinhle, are you delegating your responsibilities to someone else for responses?
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. We have a key expert on the line for that work for the situation, as I indicated earlier on.
Yes, Chairperson.
Thank you. Good still morning, Chair and honourable members and stakeholders. I'm Matlosu Kati by way of introduction. I work for the Consumer Goods Council of South Africa.
Apologies, Mema Joe. Can we have all other stakeholders mute their microphones? As well as Mamos Zinhle, can please mute your microphone so we don't have the presenter being disturbed. You may proceed, Matlo.
Thank you so much, Chair. And just to set the context in response to my feedback from the questions, I was previously an inspector of the department doing the implementing the APS Act, and I am a food science and technology expert in the matter. So with that, just to respond to the definitions, thank you for the comfort that we need to reiterate and say what we need to say here, since we have to implement this thing on the ground. So your words are really assuring. And in terms of us choosing the premium one that we would put out there, we would say we really plead that let's go back to the ground. And this talks to why we are alluding to the fact that maybe the department needs to relook, because from the onset when this thing was established in 2016-2017, I would say in my view, a proper analysis was not done as to what are the challenges, or even it could have been done internally, but it wasn't publicly provided to the general stakeholders to say the inspectors of the department are not doing a proper job, and this is the impact that is coming in terms of either the quality, that is the lack of quality from the product. So what we are saying is that can we relook at this whole inspection issue? The regulations are okay. The bill is supporting the regulations in terms of laying the law, but the inspection, as you can hear, and the number of cases that are there is very critical. And if we had to prioritize as the Consumer Goods Council in our reiteration, is that let's go back to the drawing board. And I would like to utter the words that Safka and Safta has done, Rudy, who said that not everything in terms of the principles of inspection needs to be inspected. If we look at the other countries and what they've implemented, they have prioritized the sectors that they need to focus on, so that if there's a lack of capacity, we can then focus on the key risky sectors, and then we can pool in terms of the resources that we have as a country and ensure that first and foremost, the education is provided to those producers. And also in terms of implementation, the producers know exactly what they need to comply with. So I think this is the message that goes back to the prioritization in terms of the resources that we have, and also an audit in terms of the measure of the departments. We've got people that we call that go into the farmers to support them. Literally anyone with a science degree can enforce legislation that is sitting with different other departments. So the essence of it all is that we are saying we could, as South Africa, look at the inspectorate and synchronize it so that the cost impact is limited. Because this talks to the issues of SMEs transformation and support. And this brings me to the second question that Honorable Matlatsi has asked in terms of what are the requirements of the assignees. Indeed, that needs to be deliberated, and this is why we're making inputs into what is the indirectly and directly in terms of the definition that has been proposed. And why we picked on Dairy SA. Dairy SA does inspections. It is a value add in terms of the members that pay the levies towards the dairy sector. So they are separated from the advocacy side. They do enforcement. They do and check. They work closely with the environmental health practitioners from the Department of Health that are sitting at the municipalities, so that they can have a coherent way of making sure that the sector is supported in their compliance. And from my view, in terms of how we're going to get the SMEs to another level, is if we support them with the education and enforcement together. If we're just doing enforcement without considering the education, then we're leaving a lot of them behind. And in the work that we do on the daily, we support the SMEs, we train the SMEs, we talk to them. And there's major challenges in them understanding the legislation. And this is why we are saying we are supporting that people that know and will support the sector could also be given the opportunity, like your DSAs, or established as established entities that could be in the sector. Either it's overreaching or so forth, the legal fraternity can look at that to guide us as a collective to say, now you are, there's no separation of powers. But what we're trying to say to the meeting today is that this can be done. We just need to review and relook at what could be best for South Africa to ensure that our smaller producers get to have a share in the pie. And it is possible. We just need to leverage off what the other countries have done and learn from those best practices. And I'm not sure if Zinhle or Neo, you'd want to react to the other. I see my colleague Neo.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Honourable Chair and members. Just to answer the question that was specifically asked about the overreaching in terms of the role and powers of the executive officer, I think it is critical that we go back to the drawing board in terms of exactly the fact that the Act itself actually foresaw this situation, that there may be a need down the line with the implementation of the Act that we may need to review and involve other departments such as the Department of Finance. If you look at the Act itself, in section 15.4, it does specifically say that, it says a regulation prescribing fees shall be made with the concurrence of the Minister of Finance, which means that, you know, the legislator foresaw a situation where a regulatory framework may be needed down the road. When we see now, and the concerns that are shared by some members of the portfolio committee, which we are grateful for, in the sense that the court cases are very unsustainable going into the future, and here is an opportunity for us to go and implement exactly what the Act itself foresaw, or the legislator themselves foresaw, as one day having the need to do this. So I don't think that it's actually overstretching or over really reaching in terms of asking for the executive officer to actually have some kind of accountability and governance structures put in place that will enable the executive officer to perform these duties in a manner that create certainty for the industry. And Marco has talked to the fact about the audit of the capacity of the department, and I'm glad that she shared her experiences having been in that department. I think it is critical that, you know, when an industry or anybody pays for services that are government services, that from an accountability and a point of view, that all of us are on the same page, that we're able to review what has happened. I made an example in my presentation when I said the department, up to about a month ago, actually terminated the services of two assignees. And now they're saying, oh, guess what? The department now is going itself to be performing this inspection services. For me, the logical question to ask is, where were these inspectors all these years, and how come they were not performing those functions earlier? Which means that you may have more than enough capacity within the department, because Michael, who now works for the Consumer Goods Council and used to be in the department, some of my colleagues that were there are still there in the department and are still called inspectors, but they're not performing inspection services. And up to 2 days ago, we are hearing that the department will not perform those services. So I would like to plead and say that it's not a matter of saying and not trusting, but it's a matter of saying, let's all understand whether or not the intention, because the intention that was put on the table about why these assignees are appointed in the first place was due to capacity issues and nothing else. The ministers that we are appointing because we have capacity constraints. Since then, two departments have met. And, you know, up to 2 days ago, now we're hearing that the department will itself now be conducting those inspection services. So I plead with members to say that, you know, let's look at and take a deep stick and see whether or not there isn't a need for us to really assess where we are, so that one, we save costs for the industry, two, we ring fence our services that should really have been provided for by government in the first place, that they actually reside where they're meant to. And thirdly, you know, with that, it gives, you know, taxpayers, you know, that sense of comfort that, you know, the administration is doing that which it's supposed to be doing, and that at the end of the day, there is that oversight in terms of accountability. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Can we have responses from Ntate Anthony Stein from Primero?
Mr. Chairperson, thank you. I think there are only two or three that were pertained directly to our presentation. First, I think it was Honourable Masipa and Briat, if I'm correct, raised legitimately that we haven't, or I didn't in my presentation, suggest solutions, alternatives to wording. In my defense, just two things. One is it's the length of our presentation that limits us in this regard. And secondly, we're aware of our legitimate limits as presenters, as members of the public, as it were, but we do make suggestions in a more comprehensive written document, which I offer with your leave, Mr. Chair, to share with the Parliamentary Committee, if you permit us to. So I had a more comprehensive written submission, but I'm limited in time. And we do make certain recommendations about how it might be some of these difficulties with the drafting and inconsistency might be improved. And what I'm saying is that we will gladly share that with the Portfolio Committee if we are permitted to do so. I think it was Honourable Maklatsi. Mr. Chair, I'm not sure about the correct parliamentary protocol. I'm not sure if members of the public refer to your colleagues as Honourable or if we just refer to them as Mr. But you'll correct me if I've broken the protocol in that way. But Honourable, I think it was Maklatsi, said, took note of the inconsistencies and said, perhaps legal systems will comment on them. Well, I think that's correct. We can only make our submissions in that regard, and we hope we're doing our duty and performing our responsibility to help point them out. But let me give you a further example of that, if I may, that pertains to this difficulty in the definition of audit, where there's no definition of inspection and the new definition of management control system. So the bill suggests that the audits will now mean a systematic and functionally independent examination of the management control system in order to determine whether activities and related results comply with the claims associated with the product. And then the bill defines a management control system as the manner, method of production which may be claimed through the use of a name, word, expression, reference, particulars, or indication in any manner, either by itself or in conjunction with any other verbal, written, printed, illustrated, or visual material in respect of the sale or export of a product. So now, if you insert the definition of management control system as it's proposed into the definition of an audit, this is what a court or somebody applying or trying to interpret the act is going to have to do. They're going to have to read the following sentence. It's going to be wherever the power of audit or the function of audit is provided in the act, it will now read a systematic and functionally independent examination of the manner or method of production which may be claimed through the use of a name, word, expression, reference, particulars, or indication in any manner, either by itself or in conjunction with other verbal, written, printed, illustrated, or visual material in respect effect on the sale or export of a product, and then back to the definition of audit in order to determine whether activities and related results comply with the claims associated with the product. And we would just simply suggest to your committee, without being prescriptive or judgmental, that there are much more refined or precise ways to define these things to make them able to be interpreted in a more ordinary language sort of way, so that it's clearer what the meaning is, because to interpret a clause or a sentence like that will pose enormous problems to those trying to conduct their operations, let alone if there is litigation or contestation around the interpretation. And that's just one example. But as I say, we with your leave, will share the limited recommendations we have made, but we didn't see it as our task to attempt to redraft, because there are policy and other considerations that precede that, and we're aware of the limitations of our role. And then finally, just the comment by, I think it was Honorable Twete, that there is a danger of overlapping and extending beyond the brief of this presentation. Well, I hope that you'll recognize, at least in our case, but in many of the others, that we've confined ourselves to commenting on directly on the bill that's before this portfolio committee and may or may not serve before Parliament. Our recommendation is that the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee reconsider in light of these comments and in respect of the areas of inconsistency and clarity, I think we would recommend that there be redrafting and then an opportunity for further comments if that's helpful to the Portfolio Committee.
Thank you, Dr. Anthony Stein from Primario, for your responses. Let me, honorable members, invite the last responses.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I will raise my hand, but just to get guidance from you, Chair, whether we should share the written presentation, if that will be helpful or not.
That would have been in my closing remarks.
Apologies.
But since you are eager to hear that,
I'm sorry.
All the presenters, honorable members, are allowed to make written submissions, as they may have not covered everything they wish to cover during the 20 minutes that was allocated to them. So you are most welcome to make a full written submission to the committee secretariat during the course of this week. We'll now invite the last presenters, the honorable members, which was the submission from the South African Organic Sector Organization. Let me invite Alan Rosenberg.
I think Brett is going to respond.
Yes, sorry. Alan's our chair, but I don't think he's available or in this meeting today. The question that was directed to us was the indigenous versus organic, and if there would be any consequences or discriminatory situations placed on indigenous farmers. And for us, we see it as completely inclusive. The organic standard as it is at the moment really only excludes the use of agrochemicals and agropesticides from conventional agriculture. And from our point of view, if those are not used and the systems or a natural or organic system is implemented in terms of the production methodology on the farm for a minimum of 18 months, then organic certification is seen as a possibility. Those audits would still be required. As discussed in our presentation, we have looked at a much cheaper mechanism of bringing that standard closer to the emerging farmer through the PGS system. And for us, that system is something that really we must look at more broadly in terms of the Act, because the situation that is with organic farming in this country, because there's no legislation around the definition, the term, the methodology, the practices on farm as well as in processing, it has left a lot of local area of deviation. And when we take those products into international markets, then we are not able to meet the quality standards or norms, or not, our standards would not be equivalent to those standards internationally. So for us, the base of all organic or regenerative production systems would be the non-use of agrochemicals and pesticides, and any other type of indigenous knowledge system that would have produced a crop would be looked at and allowed, obviously just not crossing those parameters of using industrial or chemical products. I think also for us, in terms of the definitions, just following from what Anthony Stein said, we, or from my personal view, and I think the view of SAWASO, is that this allowance of a management control system outside the ambit of Act 36 or the previous status quo, with that it starts recognizing these more niche farming or production techniques, whether it's organic, whether it's regenerative, whether it's traditional, whether it is QSI, a biodynamic. There's quite a few different references that would like their specific standard or mark protected underneath this bill. And it's really within the definitions of those terms and the introduction of internationally accepted norms and standards into those terms that I think we can take this conversation further. But I think it would be potentially, would dampen the value of this bill if we simplify that language around audit and management control systems further than it is. But we do believe that the allowance and the availability of systems such as PGS that limit costs and potentially offer solutions where public and private institutions and NPOs and civil society can collaborate to bring those costs down for the emerging and developing farmer. Thank you.
Any further input, Colleen?
Not from my side. Thank you very much. Thank you, Brett.
Thank you, honorable members. Those are the responses from the stakeholders and the submissions we have had today. Perhaps on my side is also to give input in terms of from today's public hearings from the stakeholders, we will be able to have the Department of Agriculture, Land Reform and Rural Development next week presenting to the committee, which it will be going to respond to both the oral and written submissions that we have been able to receive as the committee. And the honorable members may have been able to raise their concerns during questions and comments, but I would want to put it to you, honorable members, that there is nothing wrong with what the stakeholders have been able to raise during this submission, because the legislation doesn't exist or operate in vacuum. Whatever that has been raised to the portfolio committee is related to how the bill will be implemented once it becomes law. Its implication for the industry, it seeks to regulate, and the consequences for consumers. This is part of public participatory process that I mentioned earlier in the introductory remarks that I made. So let us be open-minded in this proceeding. As I've said, we have now received the oral submissions in these public hearings, and the Secretariat will keep the door open for all the written submissions to be submitted to the committee, and will be able to engage further with the department executive and officials next week on this bill. I therefore, honorable members, want to thank all of you for participating and for your robustness as always expected of you in upholding your mandate, but also want to thank all the presenters and the submissions from various stakeholders that have been able to appear before the committee on this virtual and hybrid virtual meeting that we have had this morning. We thank all our guests and most importantly, the respected members of the media that have been on the platform to ensure that these processes are captured correctly and are able to be brought into our public space for consumption. We'll thank all other parties of interest that have been with us this morning on these public hearings, honorable members. That was all on our agenda for today. We therefore close this session and the meeting stands adjourned. I'd like to remind all of you that there will be a hybrid meeting, a plenary meeting at 2 o'clock. So do log in on time and enjoy the week ahead, and send our greetings and love to your loved ones. Thank you. Bye-bye. Meeting is adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kerry.
Thank you.
Honorable Masipa. Where is he? I get the meeting is adjourned.